It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech, our second episode of the brand new Eastside Studios. Harry McCracken, the technologizer, joins us along with Jason Snell from Six Colors. We're going to talk about all sorts of stuff, including, of course, the new iPhone. It's on its way. They still haven't gotten any invitations, though. We'll talk about Apple's fight with Spotify over music, Steve Woz's reaction to the loss of a headphone jack, and Google's artificial intelligence. It beats Facebook. Who's the winner? You'll find out next on This Week in Tech.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 577, recorded Sunday, August 28th, 2016. Vulnerable to ninjas. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Eero. Why settle for a Wi-Fi router when you can have a brilliant, hyper-fast, super simple Wi-Fi system? No more buffering, no more dead zones. Finally, Wi-Fi that works. For free overnight shipping, visit Eero, EERO.com. At a checkout, select overnight shipping and enter the code TWIT. And by Texture, the mobile app that lets you access the world's most popular magazines anytime, anywhere, using your phone or tablet. For your free trial, visit texture.com/TWIT. And by GoToMeeting. Be a meeting MVP. GoToMeeting is the online meeting tool that lets you easily collaborate and present from anywhere with one click, so you always put on your best performance. Step up your meeting game and start your free 30-day trial at GoToMeeting.com. And by Trunk Club. Get clothes that fit and look amazing without ever stepping into a store again. Trunk Club will help you create the wardrobe you've always dreamed of with your own personal stylist. Go to TrunkClub.com/TWIT and join Trunk Club today. It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the week's tech news with some of the best tech journalists in the biz. And as always, we've got a great team. We're doing it in studio again in our new studio because we weren't sure if Skype would be working, but it works fine. So I think next episode we'll have people from all around, but Jason Snell just up the road a piece. Always nice to have you.
Happy to drive on up.
From sixcolors.com.
Like what you did with the place.
Yeah, different, huh? Yeah, I like it. Oh, we got bricks behind you now. That's
new. Oh, classy.
Every day there's something different.
Hello.
We put bricks in.
Do you like the bricks?
Hi. Also with us, Harry McCracken, the technologizer from fastcompany.com. Great to see you.
I have a little brick on the side.
Yeah, we're working on your side. Your side's unfinished. You have actual brick. That's real brick. We had a bricklayer come in and make that arch behind you.
We're like the three little pigs.
We are, it's hard to believe it was only a week ago we made the move. We've been only in here a week. Wow. So we welcome you to This Week in Tech. Spotify says, hey, we're not burying musicians when they make deals with Apple. That's what Bloomberg said. Maybe did they get it wrong or did they overstate the case? They say, according to their sources, Spotify, in an escalating battle between Apple and Spotify, is telling musicians who do an exclusive deal with Apple, well, guess what? We're not going to promote you. We're going to bury you, be a big part of Spotify. Spotify says, that's not true, although they didn't deny the promotion thing. This is a continuing saga between Apple and Spotify.
That's competition. I mean, I get it. I really hate the zero sum aspect of like content exclusivity where, you know, nobody is reasonably going to subscribe to both Spotify and Apple Music, which means you're always going to have things that are favorites of yours that are not going to be available. Yeah. Yeah. And I really hate that part of it. Although I do wonder in parsing the Bloomberg story if what was happening was they were telling artists that they were going to be sorry if they made deals with Apple and didn't actually do any retaliation, just sort of wanted to scare them.
Drake gave Apple Music an exclusive, right?
Right, and Frank Ocean.
That was another big one. And apparently Spotify, I mean, the leak is, and I would guess it came from Drake or Ocean's Camp, right? Said, oh, so that makes sense that Spotify threatened us, but did they actually do it? Spotify categorically denies it. We didn't do that.
You would think it would be counterproductive for Spotify to suppress things in search results, though, because right. if you're a user and you can't find the stuff people really care about, it's not going to make you look upon Spotify favorably.
So many stories in technology these days, I guess it's always been that way. The user's the one who gets screwed.
Yeah.
It's not the company's fighting. It's like dinosaurs fighting. You stay out of the way because they're going to stomp on you as a user.
Whenever you have big companies that are trying to, they feel like they're in a death struggle with one another, it's inevitably, you know, they're making decisions strategically based on their battle and not what the regular people want. And it's a shame because, like I said, you know, you're a fan of one artist and they're on Apple, so you go to Apple, and then you're a fan of that another artist and they're only on Spotify.
It's really hard.
So you're not going to subscribe to both, so then you're making decisions, and it's tough.
Music industry really is struggling. I just don't know what the answer is. I mean, I think the risk for both companies is that people will say poo-poo to both of you, and I'm just going to download it stuff from BitTorrent. And
yeah, I feel like sometimes I think that the subscription music service game is all right now about just getting everybody hooked to. I wrote a piece this week on Macworld about this, that after a year of being an Apple Music subscriber, I calculated out how much music I've added to my library that I didn't buy, because I used to buy music, but I'm not really buying music now. And it was like about $200 or $300 worth.
Wow.
And every year it compounds, right? Every year there's another year's worth of music discovery that you didn't buy. So if you were to ever quit and stop using a music subscription service, you would need to spend hundreds or more than $1,000 to get those tracks back in your personal library. So I think that's what phase we're in now, is get everybody hooked. And it would, given how little artists seem to be getting compensated for this, and maybe even record companies, right, what's the next shoe to drop? Probably that they will start increasing the prices and saying, you know, now you need to pay $20 a month. But what are you going to do? You're going to lose all your music if you don't.
Oh, that would be a bad scenario.
Right, they got us right where they want us.
That's the ultimate anti-competitive scenario, is you dominate the market by undercutting everybody else. Once everybody else goes out of business, then you can raise prices to whatever height you want.
And even if it's Apple and Google and Spotify and there's some competition there, if the music industry says, look, you need to cut us in for more, they're going to have to raise their prices
anyway.
It's going
to be Apple, Google, and Amazon. I don't know if Spotify has a shot at this. All three have other businesses that will be supported by the music biz, right? They don't need to make money. Amazon is buying, by the way, offering kind of an aggressive price, $5 a month for music, but you can only listen on the Echo.
Right. I think that's a smart idea. I think the story was that they're trying
thinking
to
of it?
Do that,
okay.
Something like that.
Okay, yeah.
I think that's pretty smart because as somebody who has an Echo, I'm willing to pay Amazon a little bit to add features to the Echo, and that's sort of what that is. It's not really Spotify. It's being able to access that library on the Echo.
Right now you get Amazon Prime Music, which is pathetic.
My mom would totally pay $5 a month to get on her Echo.
Actually, my in-laws, we gave them an Echo. They're happy because they can listen to Elvis, Bill Haley's comments. Amazon Prime Music has the stuff that they want to hear. Well, it's the modern stuff. It doesn't.
Well, my mom likes opera, and she says the Prime Music opera selection is
not
terrible.
So good.
I'm hoping for $5 she could beef it up.
Speaking of which, either of you get an invitation to any events that Apple might be doing anytime in the next couple of weeks?
Not yet.
We'll get them Wednesday, right?
The next few days would be the logical time frame.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I say wheel like I'd get one. No, you'll get them Wednesday. For an event which we all, I think, seem to kind of converge on the date, September 7th. That's the Wednesday after Memorial Day. Would be normally September 7th, a Tuesday, or 6th, a Tuesday, but the 7th is the Wednesday. And then the rumor mill was that September 9th for pre-order, that's the Friday following at midnight. That's typically how Apple does it. And then the further rumor is the September 23rd, 2 weeks after that, for the first deliveries. We stand by that? Does that sound right? You guys,
Apple Wednesday after Labor Day the last couple of years. Yeah. It was the 9th.
This is the pattern. Although nobody says Apple has to do it the same way every year.
Sometimes they break their pattern. But there have been reports that say specifically that that's the date. So I think it's probably the date.
You'd be, did I say Memorial Day? I meant Labor Day. It'd be a hideous mistake to buy an iPhone today. Maybe not.
People do it, though.
I like headphone jacks. I cannot lie.
Stock up.
It might be time to stock up on the old headphone jack. You know, Steve Gibson, who does security now, he'll fall in love with the technology. He really liked a particular BlackBerry. And he thought, well, if they ever stop making it, I'm going to be out of luck. So he froze them. He actually put them in sealed. He puts them in the freezer so they don't decay. I say, sometimes you should go through your freezer, Steve, and throw out stuff that you don't really care about anymore, like a BlackBerry. He's abandoned his BlackBerries. I think he had a Pilot in there for a while.
Well, I only do that with film for my Polaroid camera.
Film? That makes sense.
It's tied to a service, that's the problem, right? Yeah. It's like the people who were using that first generation TiVo who discovered that after 16 years, even if it works fine,
should I worry about service. My TiVo? I did the wrong thing. I bought a year lifetime subscription for two different TiVos. Hideously expensive, almost as much as the TiVo itself.
I have one too.
Because they have monthly. And then TiVo gets sold to Rovio or Rovi.
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 And Rovio's the Angry Birds company. Rovi's a company that sells soft.
They make an electronic program guide.
The former MacroVision, now doing programming.
That's MacroVision.
And they own like TV listings.
And they've got all the patents too.
Oh,
in fact, that's why the original TiVo is dying, is because TiVo didn't use Rovi as its guide source. So that was the first thing they changed. And they didn't want to update the software on the original TiVo to support the new Rovi data. So
Rovi kind of forced them into this.
Yeah, this is the first step. But
that's what I'm paying a monthly fee for is the program guide.
Essentially, or you're not. You're paying the lifetime fee instead.
So although were we suckered, Harry?
Which is not really a lifetime.
It's lifetime of the device.
Lifetime of the box.
Yeah.
But I hope that box will last some 10 more years, given it's, you know, it was expensive. Very expensive. But I love my TV.
Which model is it?
Oh, I got the Romeo Pro. I got the top of the line. We all are TiVo.
We all have TiVo, yeah.
TiVo was the best, but now it's sold, and now I'm wondering what the hell's going to happen.
It's still the best if you want to pay a lot more than your cable box. I think it is the best. The lifetime, I think it doesn't pencil out that after about 2 years, you make back what you spend.
Over the monthly, because the monthly's a lot. It's like $16 or $20 a month is a lot for a program guide. And I was just talking to somebody who has a Channel Master, which is an over-the-air TiVo. And the program guide's free. There's no monthly. So I really have to wonder if I've been suckered. But we know what? We go willingly because it's the best DVR. I can't use the I have the Comcast X1. It's horrible. It's horrible. And Comcast is selling it like it's the best thing ever. It's horrible. Maybe I'm a little prejudiced. Not a fan. Anything to say about the new iPhone? It will be called this, but they'll do the 7 and the 7. S, 7 and 7 Plus.
7 and 7 Plus, I think, is the rumor.
They'll be same sizes as the current 6?
Yeah, it may even fit in the same cases.
May even look the same, like they don't change the body.
Apparently, the back is a little different in terms of the cutouts for the antennas.
Right.
But if you were blindfolded and holding it in your hand, you might be hard-pressed. You have to feel around for the headphone jack.
Which I never find it.
Oh, that's sad.
The 6S, according to Mac Rumors, beats the Galaxy Note 7 in a speed test. You know, I'm here. I love the Note 7. I have the Note 7 somewhere here. But I'm hearing more and more XDA developers complaining about the Note 7. They say no reviewer uses Samsung phones long enough to experience the inevitable degradation in speed that happens after a few months.
It's a real issue with reviewing phones. You get it and it feels snappy while you're reviewing.
It's great now. But I won't have it in 2 weeks.
If you're
right?
lucky, you have a week to review it, and it seems fine. And if you use it a few weeks afterwards, it gets bogged down. It's like a Windows machine from the old days, except sometimes it seems like it happens at a much more accelerated pace.
What about this issue with speed? I think part of the problem with Samsung devices is TouchWiz, Samsung's UI that they put on top of it.
Not called TouchWiz anymore. The new one has.
What's it called? What's the new suck. One?
Grace, I think it's the Grace UI.
The Grace UI. It seems, now, the Samsung is using an 820, a Qualcomm 820 here in the U.S. It's using its own Samsung Exynos processor worldwide. The A9, of course, and the iPhone. The Samsung has 4 gigs of RAM. The A9 has only 2 gigs of RAM. But according to, now, it's somewhat of a synthetic test.
Yeah, well, so this guy, I watched this video. It's a pretty good video. But when you look at his testing, he's kind of launching apps and getting them to the starting point. He's not really running
Not doing what
Geekbench
you and I
or something
would
like
do.
That. But what his test does do is it launches a bunch of fairly large, intense apps they have to load into memory, and then he presses the home button and launches another one, and he does this twice. And the idea there is you're measuring I/O a little bit and a little bit of processor and a lot of memory. It's how long does it take to get to the screen, and
boy,
then you move back. And
4 gigs of RAM would beat 2 gigs of RAM.
And what ends up happening is that's where the iPhone really pulls ahead, is that it keeps all that stuff in memory so that when he goes back and circles back for a second lap, all of those things load immediately, and the Samsung is still having to sort of relaunch them. But what does it mean?
Is that memory management? But does it affect you in real life?
Right? I mean, this tells us definitively what happens if all you ever do is launch apps and close them, which is not how we use our phones.
14 apps. The Galaxy Note 7 launched 14 apps in 1 minute and 21 seconds. I'm sorry, that was the iPhone, and then the Note 7 took 2 minutes and 4 seconds. But if you launch a lot of apps in sequentially, I guess this would be real world, but it's not. What does it tell us? It tells us they handle memory better?
It says something about memory management.
Yeah. And I/O, disk speed.
When I reviewed the iPad Pro, which had double the RAM of previous iPads, I sat there and I opened browser tabs over and over and
you're
over
still
again
using that iPad Pro.
Until it started to reload
and
found that, when you have twice the RAM, you can open a lot more tabs.
Yeah.
But my sense is that Apple is better at memory management, partially because it generally speaking, does not have the most available RAM compared to,
it has to be,
to Android. Android phone makers throw faster chips and more memory at their devices, which theoretically will make them a lot more robust, but does not always.
It's also a measure of the control of the platform, right?
Sure.
Apple exerts tighter control on its developers, and of course, as a result, maybe can be more predictable. The environment could be more predictable.
And it's a very limited number of phone models with a very limited hardware set, which means they're optimizing for the specific use. Even if you count like every iPhone model and every iPhone SKU, they're all using a small number of processors and they know what the RAM is, and they know exactly, right? And on Android, it's much more complicated.
Yeah.
There's no carrier bloatware on an iPhone.
Do you think that ARM being sold will make a difference to Apple? Or I'm seeing stronger rumors that Apple's going to move the desktop line, the laptops, to ARM.
People have been talking about that a long time, but they would have to get something out of it. I mean, the latest speculation I saw, you get some battery life, but you're losing compatibility and you're not going to get a speed boost. They got a speed boost when they went to Intel.
Right.
And going to ARM, it's probably going to be faster. It will probably be slower.
Yeah.
And anything runs in compatibility will be even slower. But there was John Gruber linked to a story on Daring Fireball from like a year ago that suggested what if what Apple did was use – one of them was what if Apple uses Intel to build its next generation of A chips for iOS.
Intel's going to be making it ARM chips.
And then what if Apple used AMD to build an x86 compatible Apple design chip for the Mac, which these are fun conspiracy theories. Yeah, I know.
Wow.
I don't know. I mean, you can't say Apple would never do it, because I feel like this is the kind of stuff that Apple undoubtedly has investigated whether they would ever actually do it. I don't know.
Intel making all the Apple chips makes more sense, at least intuitively, than moving the Mac.
Both x86 and ARM.
You're moving the iPhone on, and I can see.
You also get Samsung out of the game, which you'd love to do.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, Apple and Intel have worked together really well for a long time and are in different lines of business.
And Intel desperately needs to get in mobile.
It would be such a great thing for Intel to get that business.
Intel of 5 years ago would not say, we're going to make an ARM chip for Apple. The Intel of today maybe would be like happy to get that business.
Yeah, interesting. We live in interesting times. Mm-hmm. iFixit is pinpointed, and I'm, again, curious about your thoughts on this. What they say is a design defect in the iPhone 6 Pluses. Those are the bendy.
Yeah, the really big phone.
The S Plus has reinforcement to keep it less bendy. And they say the torque, just not that it's going to buckle the phone, but the torque that it experiences in your back pocket is enough to clobber the touch sensing chips on the phone. And so I haven't seen a lot of this, but apparently it's not uncommon to get a gray bar at the top of your iPhone and for the touch sensor to be less sensitive to missed touches. And that is a symptom that eventually degrades because of the torque on. There's that gray bar if you're looking at the video. It's not immediately obvious, but it's a flickering bar. And the evidence is that if you press it, sometimes it'll fix it temporarily, but inevitably it gets worse. And that there are a lot of third-party repair shops which are re-soldering the touch chips on this little daughter board. The apparently what's happening is the flexion is breaking these little solder beads underneath the chip and causing it to be unreliably connected to the daughter board. Re-soldering it fixes it. Not reflowing it, but actually you have to do micro-soldering. And apparently Apple won't do it. They call it touch disease. Apple won't do it. They just say, "No, we'll give you a new phone." Why not? They got lots of them.
Yeah, if you're in warranty. I think that's the right. For me, this is the big question here is, if you're in warranty, you take it back to Apple and they're like, "Oh, you're right. This is there's something wrong here. We'll fix it." But the 6 Plus shipped 2 years ago.
It's 2 years old, so it's out of warranty.
So unless you've got extended Apple Care or something like that, it's out of warranty. And this seems to be the big question mark is if this is really a design flaw in that phone, Apple should probably make good on replacements for everybody who has this problem. And you know, that's the question. How many people have this problem? Are they taking it to Apple? Is Apple aware of it?
Right.
What's their policy? Do they refuse or do they quietly swap phones? I don't know, but I feel like if this is a fundamental flaw in the way that phone was built, then they should do right by their customers, even if those phones are out of warranty.
And this always happens, and this is also an unfortunate thing Apple does, but one of the third-party repair guys posted on the Apple forums a paragraph explaining that if you're experiencing these problems, if you're under warranty, get Apple to fix it. If you're out of warranty, there may be a fix. He says it's an extremely common issue in the 6 and 6 Plus. Here's the fix. And if you look at the post later, edited by host, i.e. Apple, and they delete that whole thing about how you could fix it at a third-party repair shop. Apple's policy, of course, is don't use third-party repair ever. On the other hand, if Apple's not going to fix it, I don't see why you shouldn't use a third-party repair shop. But you understand you're now taking it out of warranty.
Well, you can go to an Apple store and pay for an out-of-warranty replacement.
And they'll replace it.
Which is more expensive than an in-warranty replacement.
Do they replace the logic board or they replace the whole phone?
I don't know. I it would be a good question to ask who could say at Apple.
Right. It sounds like they don't do the fix in the store.
They don't do the re-solder, They don't do micro-soldering.
Yeah, they might give you a new phone, refurb phone.
Pretty typical. That's pretty typical of a OEM that they're going to...
I've never heard of anybody with this problem, but it does sound, now that somebody wrote about it, there is certainly some set of people. And the problem with a device that's sold as many units as even the iPhone 6 Plus is, what's the percentage failure here?
Right.
Is it 1/100th of 1% or is it 1%?
But either is significant when you sell 100 million phones.
Yeah, yeah. So. Well, if is this 1,000 people affected or is it 20,000 people affected or 100,000 people? Right. We don't know.
Yeah, and all we're seeing on this, and by the way, a great article from iFixit, former sponsor. We love iFixit, and Julia Bluff has been on the show.
Yeah.
She wrote the article. They're
this
very
is
good.
Right up their alley.
Yeah, and she talked to a micro soldering specialist. By the way, I say it wrong, I know. Don't write to me, all our British fans. It's Leo, it's soldering.
No, not in the United States.
Soldering.
Sorry.
Solder.
Sorry.
We probably sound stupid saying solder. There's an L in there. Don't you see it?
Oh, it's rich for the British to complain about not pronouncing letters. Come on. They gave that to us.
How do you say Worcestershire? All right. All right. They gave us that. It's your
That's
legacy.
Right. Thank you.
Harry McCracken is here. He's technology editor of Fast Company and technologizer.com. And, of course, our great friend as well, Jason Snell from Six Colors. He bleeds Six Colors on the Twitter, and he podcasts at The Incomparable. And Pod for Ham, still going?
Still going.
You got a lot of mileage at it. Like 42 tracks on the album.
It's honestly exhausting. It's going through the end of the year.
I think you're done.
And I wish we had done it faster.
Two at a time.
But by the end of the year, we'll be done with every track from Hamilton.
And you're still doing the theater?
Radio theater will be coming back hopefully this fall or early next year. And there's a missing episode that we're hopefully going to release in the next couple of months that has you in it as a monster. So
you never posted that?
No, that's still sitting there.
What?
I know.
I'm on the cutting room floor.
No, you're a lost episode. You're going to be a special edition pretty soon.
My great acting debut. Hey, look at this. We're going to take a break. Come back with more. This, you both have used these. I know you both reviewed them. I reviewed it. I'll be honest. The first time I reviewed it, I must have had a broken unit. It didn't do anything for me. Then they sent me another one, and I went boing. It was like Roger Rabbit. This is the Eero, E-E-R-O, and it solves a problem so many of us have, which is bad Wi-Fi. Bad Wi-Fi. It's funny, when Wi-Fi first started, it worked really well, and then neighbors got it, and the neighbors' neighbors, and everybody upstairs and downstairs got it. And pretty soon, you're saturated with Wi-Fi signals, and suddenly you've got dead zones, you've got buffering, you're trying to watch Netflix, and it's just not flicks. It's terrible. That's because routers are generally crap, and they don't wear out well. They wear out fast. Eero is a new way of doing routers. It replaces the old – let me open this up. It's so cool. Replaces the old single router model with multiple routers. Now, you can get an individual Eero, and for a small apartment, that might be enough. In our house, we got the 3 Eero set. And you can even add more Eeros to it. And they – I don't – I'm going to get this technically wrong. But I'm going to use the term mesh. Each Eero is kind of independent. It's not a repeater with a main unit. But they do some really interesting things with the Eero. For instance, the Eeros, unlike any other router I know of, get updated automatically regularly. The Eeros also tune the network for the kinds of devices you have on the network. So if you have a Roku on your network, they recognize that and they go, oh yes, we can handle that. They do things like QoS automatically because of it. This is an enterprise-grade Wi-Fi system that can be set up in your home, but it's easy because it uses your smartphone, your iPhone or your Android phone for the setup. So you place your first Eero where your main access point is. And then you fire up the phone. It recognizes the Eero, logs you into the Eero system. Often you get firmware upgrades, like every day, but you don't have to worry about it. It just happens. You then say you walk down the hall and you put another Eero in, and it tells you, yeah, you're good, or nope, needs to be closer or farther. Of course, it uses all the things that we recommend. There's no WPS. That's dangerous. There's WPA2 encryption. They have a guest network system that really works where you can actually send somebody a one-time-only password. It is gorgeous. As you can see, it looks great in your house. And, of course, there's a 30-day money-back guarantee. So I'm just going to tell you my experience. Once we put the Eero in, all of a sudden, I used to get a lot of complaints. The Wi-Fi's down again. And, of course, I'm the guy who has to go figure out what's going on, reboot the router, all that. Ever since we put the Eero in, marvelous. Not only 5 bars everywhere, including walking down the drive back to all the way. I mean, just going long. The reason I know this is we'd play Pokemon Go, and it'd take me a long time to get off Wi-Fi and onto the 4G network. It was a lot farther, but also faster. One of the great things, it tells you your bandwidth right now. It does a bandwidth test on a regular basis, so you know immediately if your bandwidth is degrading or getting better. It is really awesome. Eero.com. And right now we're giving you free overnight shipping when you use the offer code TWIT. Eero.com. If you've been thinking about the Eero, let me just tell you, it works great. Eero.com. And the offer code is TWIT. We're talking about the week's tech news with Harry McCracken. Jason Snell. Roberto Baldwin was going to join us. I think you probably know he broke his foot, and he's apparently on heavy painkillers. Yeah. So he said, I could come in, but I don't think it would be very...
Stay home, Robbie. Stay home.
Yeah. Robbie, you'll get better. We're thinking of you. I'm just teasing
him. He live tweeted his breaking his ankle. It was terrible.
He's connected.
There's this picture, and he's like, I think something's wrong here.
Oh.
Like, yeah.
Poor guy. We love Robbie, and get better soon, and we'll have Roberto Baldwin back. Very soon. Apparently, Intel is already in talks with Apple over ARM-based chips, according to Mac Rumors, for future iOS devices. Didn't they? The rumor is this year that the iPhone 7 will use TSMC, Taiwan Silicon Semiconductor Manufacturing chips only. Not Samsung chips.
They do use them as a manufacturer, so yeah. I don't know. I don't know.
That's a rumor I heard.
I mean, that's the thing about Apple's chips is they design them, but somebody has to.
Somebody has to make them. They don't have
that partner. Could be Samsung. It could be
Intel. Nothing wrong with that. I just saw a tweet the other day saying, "Woz, you should stop either stop working for Apple or stop bashing Apple." Woz, we love you. Christina Warren writing for her new employer, Gizmodo. Congratulations, Christina. She'll be on soon. I think maybe next week. Woz to Apple, you don't know Jack. We love Woz. What did he say? He said, like many of us, where's the headphone jack? He said that would be a bad idea. Now, remember, Apple has not yet shown a product, so we're still speculating. He was talking to the Australian Financial Review. Woz says he wants to move to Australia. He loves Australia. He said, quote, if the iPhone 7 is missing the 3.5-millimeter earphone jack, that's going to tick off a lot of people. I would not use Bluetooth. I do not like wireless. I have cars where you can plug in the music or go through Bluetooth, and Bluetooth just sounds so flat for the same music. He likes the physical adapter. Of course, if Apple does take the headphone jack out, they'll ship a lightning-to-headphone jack adapter, I'm sure. But he says he's ticked off. Apple is good at moving towards the future, and this is one way you do it. You don't know Jack. It's a great headline. Thank you, Christina. I had to give you credit for that. And a nice picture of a happy, smiling Woz.
I guess that's actually a grimace of pain. thinking about losing the headphone jack.
Woz could be talking about Satan and he'd be smiling. He's just a happy guy.
He is a happy guy.
When you read the article, he's not even mad at Apple. It's just like, I hope they don't get rid of the jack. I like the jack. Okay, enough about the jack. We'll be talking about that a lot in 2 weeks.
I suspect so, yeah.
Yeah. Nougat? You want to talk about Nougat? Hmm? Do you use Nougat? You don't use Android.
I've got that. I've got a, 5X? 5X, yeah.
I have my 5X with Nougat right
adorable
here.
Adorable 5X,
I have
yeah.
a 6. It's adorable. It's so small.
It is.
Android 7.
It's pretty.
Do you think that cell phone companies now time everything around Apple's announcements? Like, let's get this Note 7 out. Let's get Nougat out. Before Apple takes all the oxygen out of the atmosphere with its announcement.
Maybe. I mean, it's also we're rolling to the holidays, and the holiday quarter is usually a very good sale quarter. So for everybody, including Apple, which is why Apple has their big event in September. But yeah, you don't want to get swamped by Apple. You want to.
And I mean, for a lot of people who own Android phones, it is almost disappointing when a new version of Android comes out because you have no clue when you're going to get it. It might be months.
It is.
And months
it's heartbreaking for yeah. most people, right?
That's why I have the 5X. It's nice to have a phone.
If you have a Nexus
you can be
phone,
confident you can get it quickly. Yeah.
And even then, you may not have gotten an over-the-air update unless you were in the beta program. I got it the day of, but you had to be in the beta program.
I signed up for the beta program so I could get it day of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like 2 seconds later, I had it.
I think there are people with a 6P who still haven't gotten it. You know what? No big deal. There's some nice features. It's all right. We're at the point now where this stuff is so mature, it's hard to make any big change. They've got night shift. They've got... actually, you have to turn on a feature to get night shift. You have to turn on the UI tuner. It's a little trick to turn that on, and then you can turn on night shift, the yellow screen, so it doesn't wake you up in the middle of the night. They have... you hit double tap the recents. It goes to the last app you used. You can pin apps. And it's mostly got better notifications. Something Apple's adding with iOS 10 as well. The ability to interact with notifications right from the notification.
The battery life is supposedly better. Although
I've noticed better battery life.
I haven't seen it on the 5X, not that I've benchmarked it.
It didn't have great battery life to begin with. But my 6P seems better, but you're right. I haven't. Not a rigorous test.
No, we are definitely at the point where everybody...
These are minor.
They're coloring around the margins here. Yeah. These are all... I see people still arguing about the iPhone and Android phones, and it's just like, you know, they're not... They are what they want to be now. It's not like you can say the iPhone is lacking a feature that Android has or Android's lacking a feature that iOS has. And in most cases, those are for sort of reasons of where they want to take those platforms. They're not... The space race is over. They're just... They are what they are, and you get to choose.
I think you're exactly right.
And we know that Windows is not going to be a serious threat on phones, and it seems unlikely that anything else
sorry,
is
I shouldn't laugh. What a shock.
For a while, I mean, God, it was so much fun to write about the wars a few years ago.
I wish Windows Phone had done better. It should have done better by all rights.
Yeah, but at some point, even Microsoft decided this is not worth pouring resources
into. What killed Windows Phone, you think?
I think that it was competing against these deeply entrenched products, and
it, in some it was too late?
And in some alternate universe, Microsoft got on the phones that weren't iPhones before Android came along. But once Android was so deeply entrenched, it was very hard for Microsoft to convince phone makers to use its operating system, particularly in the era where it was trying to get them to pay for Windows Phone on their devices.
Yeah, I kind of want to. I kind of want to come up with a scenario that blames the carriers. I just want to, because they're blamable. Nobody loves Verizon, AT&T, Sprint. Even T-Mobile is getting less lovable over time.
And I think they all showed a fair amount of vision in latching on to Android. And the hardware
makers,
obviously.
They were all in on Android. And you could go into any store from any carrier, and the chances of them showing you a Windows Phone or even admitting its existence were nil. Right.
There was this period where the iPhone came out and the rest of the industry needed to figure out what to do. And the single most important thing the rest of the industry did was center around Android. And once that had happened, it was really tough for Windows. Just as in the 90s, it would have been very hard for another operating system such as Linux to come along and chip away at Windows.
Are we in the wrong business? I feel like there's nothing more to talk about. It's like boring.
It is still August.
This is the bad month. I understand, but we are at peak phone. We're not going to see any massive improvement.
It's true.
We're debating about whether the headphone jack, like, that's the minorest thing of all.
I think, you know how, like, there's a problem with scale in, like, a chart when there's, like, a huge number and all the other numbers? Like, when I do a chart about Apple, you put the iPhone on there and then you have the Mac and the iPad. And it's like, you can't even see the variation.
It's on the bottom.
So small. I feel like, in some ways, that's the issue with dealing with tech today is the smartphone thing, the uptick of everybody in the world getting a supercomputer in their pocket, that kind of product may not happen again in our lifetimes. I really think that you may look at the last, you know, 50 years and say, this is what it was all leading to. And there will be great stuff in the future. There'll be VR stuff and who knows what else. But this is a once-in-a-generation kind of thing that we just saw. And everything's going to pale in comparison to the rise of the smartphone for a while.
Right.
I think so.
Where will the next so in the early days of computing, there were battles over platform, Windows versus Macintosh. There were discussions over performance of the Intel chips, the 32-bit versus 16-bit and later 64-bit. I mean, there were legitimately great battles and great changes being made. But we've got to the point now where Intel hasn't bothered doing much to improve its chips in years, right? I mean, they're all minor. You know, we're 5% better. I mean,
well, there's some physics there too, right?
Right. I understand. I'm not complaining. I'm not complaining. I'm just saying this is kind of. So where are we going to get excited? Is it going to be AR, VR?
I think AI is going to be a huge battle.
AI,
and you may see, you know, some companies that seem to be doing well now stumble because they don't get AI, and you if there are small companies that suddenly become really important, it might be because they do cool stuff with AI.
We can have this conversation because the three of us have been around for decades. We've covered this. We've seen the ups and downs, the highs and lows. You certainly have, Harry. And I guess I can't think of a period like this where everything was as mature as it is and kind of settled. We got very excited about virtual reality. And I don't want to say it's a flop, but it doesn't seem to be changing the world.
It's a long-term thing. It's the next 10, 20, 30 years.
If you think about personal computers, if you look at the ads of personal computers in the 80s, it's a whole lot of you'll keep your recipes on it, you'll do your books on it, all these things that turned out to be completely impractical.
Right.
What it was good for is kids.
I used to balance my checkbook. Now you can't even buy checkbook balancing
exactly.
software.
I know, it's outrageous. But if you look back at that, you think, well, that wasn't really, computers weren't really practical back then. How long did it take for the entire world to embrace what computers could do to change their lives? And the answer is probably until the smartphone happened, at which point now everybody is on the internet and everybody's got...
That was a
got,
massive change.
Right?
You're right.
But you, if you want to time it from the first PC, that's 25 years of it being kind of not very good and most people not wanting it.
It was 25 years, right?
You can start in 1975 80, if you want to.
Yeah, or yeah, 30 years.
Right? So I think VR is maybe like that, where and AR. Where,
yeah, but
where
look at the smartphone. That was less than 10 years.
Yeah.
That was from 2007 when Apple announced the iPhone.
But the smartphone is just a continuation of the laptop and of the desktop, right? I think it really is just part of that same story of the PC.
Oh, this is quantitatively different than a
right.
PC.
Although, I mean, the first smartphones came out, and I reviewed one, I think, in 1994.
What was that?
It was the IBM Simon. So there were like 13 years of smartphones, including...
These were not so smart.
But there was the Treo and the BlackBerry.
Yeah, which the Treo.
I loved my Palm, and I loved the Treo.
To this day, the iPhone shows stuff that it took from the Treo and from...
So there it is, the IBM Simon.
Yes, I reviewed that for InfoWorld.
Wow.
And it was the brick of all bricks.
But what's interesting is it looks like one of those brick Nokia brick phones, but it had a big screen on it. It didn't have a dial pad.
It had a big
It was all
screen.
On screen. And this was, I presume, a touch screen.
Yes.
Either that or it was very frustrating to use.
Well, both.
It was resistance.
It was a rather primitive.
It wasn't capacitance.
I mean, I think it came out about the same time the Palm Pilot came out, so it didn't even draw inspiration from that. It drew it from maybe the Newton.
Oh, man.
But it took 13 years from that until the iPhone. So people sometimes say that the PC began in 1981 with the IBM PC, which is not true because there were all those years of computers before that.
Right.
And there were all those years of smartphones before the iPhone came along.
Right. So that's when I think of VR and AR, it's stuff like that. It is like Harry said, there's a long ramp there. And something like the Oculus Rift or the HTC Vive, These are the Simon.
They're the IBM Simons.
Right? These are not the end point. These are the starting point.
It's not even the iPhone.
We're going to look back on them and laugh at it was so big you had to attach it to a PC, all of these things, that it may take 10 or 20 years to really get it so that it's in our glasses and you just don't even think about it.
And maybe the Rift is like the original Treo, because given that VR has also been around for a long time, you can go back to the 90s. And look at all the experiments that were done then.
You can watch President Obama tour Yosemite in virtual reality. Mm-hmm. That's immersive video. That's not virtual reality.
Well, it's right. It's not quite the same thing. And they're rolling a bunch of stuff together. They've got one of those 360 cameras, and they're taking the video. Although I think it's brilliant to have a 360 video of the President of the United States, because I think one of the most fascinating things with anything involving the president is to look around and see who's with the president, who's watching the president.
You never see them, do
right?
You?
So turning the I looked at this and I turned the other way to see like how many people does he have with him in that meadow?
Right. You never see the fire truck.
Exactly.
There's a fire truck when the helicopter lands in case what? It bursts into flame. Well, we've got to be ready. That's interesting. So you're right. We don't ever get to see this kind of. Here's the president and a ranger. That's what you'd see on TV.
Yeah.
Then you look behind it and you see a bear. No, there's nothing.
No, that's
what did they
cool.
edit them out? There's nobody.
They knew that was a 360 thing. They put the camera down in the river and they left.
Okay, you guys, you Secret Service guys, you're gonna have to leave.
Hide behind that tree.
What? There's nobody. There's nothing.
They don't tend to let the bears too close to the president.
Oh, now we're going. Now we're talking. Now you can see all the people in behind a log.
Yeah.
They're hiding behind a log. Don't look at us now. Yosemite is beautiful. The thing about VR is it shows well. The first time you use it, you go, wow, I can look around. I can see everything that's going on. This is amazing. We had yesterday on the new screensavers an open source underwater robotic explorer. $1,200. It's a drone for underwater.
Hmm.
And they're developing a VR helmet so you can put on your Gear VR and go with this drone. And the guy said, and I believe him, it's mind-boggling. It's like you're swimming, you know, under the ocean and exploring, you know, shipwrecks and things like that. But that shows well. But then after you do that for a while, it's like, oh, that was nice. It's not useful. really. HoloLens to me is a little more exciting, but this is way, way off. This is Microsoft's augmented reality. We're learning a little bit more about it. It has a 24-core specialized holographic processor designed by TSMC, the Taiwan silicon company. They call it the HPU. But it's really clear that HoloLens, anybody who's tried it, is just a demo at this point. Wait, have you tried it, right, Aaron?
I've gone through several rounds of the demos they've done at events like the Build Conference.
And it's just a demo at this point. I mean, you can do stuff, but it's not anywhere near what it's got to be a product.
I mean, they are doing stuff like getting Minecraft ready and so forth, but it's, what, $3,000, I think primarily because they don't want actual consumers to come anywhere near it yet.
Right.
They only want developers to take a look at it.
It's the developer edition. Yeah. I think this is going to be important. But so how far off are we for this? 10 years?
For VR in general? Or
VR and AR. I think AR is the next generation of user interface.
I think there's going to be some good and useful stuff a lot sooner than that.
Good.
For gaming, I mean, VR is just amazing right now.
Good. I'm just trying to think what the next big thing is so we can get a show together and cover it. I mean, you already got Hamilton, so I don't know. I don't know where we go from here.
But to come back to AI for a second, I think there's a pretty good chance
that we
will interact with our smartphones quite differently in a few years.
That's a tough one, though. I mean, we've been promising, for instance, speech to text, good dictation, for 30 years, and it's not quite, still not quite there. It's better.
Way better than
it's
it was.
It's gotten a lot better.
These things are harder to do. The real human scale things are harder to do than we think.
But that dovetails with the AI conversation, right? That one of the ways that you do this is by realizing you can't write a program to do it. You have to have some sort of deep learning system that will try
so
all the possibilities and find the ones
that work. We're training the future masters of the universe.
Right, maybe now. So. I mean, when you look at one of these tools that auto-translates from one language to another, they're still rudimentary and probably in that recipe keeper phase, but they are kind of amazing, and you can see that in 5 or 10 years, you may be able to have a Skype conversation with anybody speaking any language and understand them.
So that's it. Now I'm getting some perspective here. We've got, you know, a current layer of technology that is mature, that is not going to change a whole lot. It's going to evolve gently and gradually. Things like the smartphone, desktop computing. I don't know if that's evolving or dying. Tablets. And then we're in the very early demo stage of the next big thing. So we're kind of in this interregnum. Harry, do you remember this happening before? Do you remember? I don't think so. Not in technology.
I mean, the early 90s is being, more like the mid to late 90s is being a little bit boring, because at the time it seemed like Microsoft was going to dominate everything.
That
forever.
Was boring, yeah.
And Apple was around but was not being innovative. And, you know, Microsoft Office dominated its category, and you had to use IE whether you wanted to or not. And it was not clear what the next big thing would be. But a few years after that, stuff got really exciting again really quickly. So I always come back to the fact that if in late 2006 you would try to predict the next 5 years, no matter who you were and how smart you were, you would have gotten most of it wrong just because almost nobody knew about the iPhone. And even beyond smartphones, so much of what we do today is driven by stuff that started on the iPhone. I feel it's entirely possible that
drones wouldn't be here without iPhones.
Yeah, I feel entirely possible there's 5 years from now, things will be radically different in ways we don't understand yet.
Right.
Maybe VR will accelerate a lot more quickly than we expect it to.
Well, that's important, too, because even in the first couple of years of the iPhone, it wasn't apparent that this was a game changer. It was already here, but it wasn't apparent that this was going to be the revolution that it ended up being.
There were all those people who said that it wouldn't be, or that it was a huge disappointment.
Steve Ballmer. Yeah. Okay, so that's
nobody's going to use a phone without physical buttons on it.
How
Let's just
could
be
that?
Clear.
And, by the way, and Ballmer said this, who's going to buy a phone that costs $600? That's crazy talk.
I mean, supposedly the BlackBerry guys were super relieved after they saw the iPhone because it was clear that was not going to matter all that much after all.
Oh, that's kind of a classic story that will go down in history. That's nothing.
I think a lot of smart people also did realize it was really important.
Right. We did.
The moment they saw the keynote.
Well, the Android team did, right? Because they had a whole thing that was very BlackBerry-like, and they immediately said, that's it.
Yeah.
We can't do that. This is the new thing.
It's all going to be about the funnel slab.
Just to put the VR thing in perspective, I mean, you talk about the price of these things being really high. The original Mac in $2016 was like more than $5,000 today.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the same thing. Yeah. It's not priced for everyone. Yeah. It's priced for people who want to try out something very, very new. And it'll be years before it's affordable for
everyone. I have we haven't hung it yet, but a framed 2FX motherboard. Remember how expensive that was?
That was like $5,000 in the mid-80s.
It stood for too effing expensive is what it was, yeah.
But it was wicked fast.
It was. It was the power tool. It had a bus. You could put cards on it. That was an amazing device. All right. We got lots more to talk about. But we had a great week here on Twit, in our first week in our new studio. And we've prepared a small vignette of scenes from this week's shows. Take a look.
Previously on Twit.
This is our first show from the brand new Eastside Studio. Love it. We're looking very virtual there in the studio.
Security Now.
Johns Hopkins team of cryptographers led by Matthew Green presented a paper disclosing a series of weaknesses in Apple's iMessage technology allows for retrospective decryption of encrypted iMessages. I can't think of a more perfect example of the danger of a protocol being closed. The protocol should be able to withstand scrutiny.
The new screensavers.
You've seen underwater drones before. I mean, that's how they discovered the Titanic. Imagine owning your own. This is from OpenROV.
All you need is Chrome and Wi-Fi. So we've got a Raspberry Pi 3 on board, and you can control it with any device you like.
Could you hook a VR rig up to it?
Oh, my God, yeah.
This week in Enterprise Tech.
Google is upset with sites that spoil the mobile experience with pop-ups. Google wants search results to favor sites that have the best information and the least annoying advertising that covers up that information.
I really love Emily the Strange's idea. Maybe we should have a Rotten Tomatoes ranking for websites. Yeah, shame them. You're Catholic. Shame works, right?
No.
Twit.
We tried.
It's not your father's twit.
It's always nice to have a priest there. Jason Howell has a look at what's coming up this week on Twit.
Thanks, Leo. Here are a few things we're going to be keeping a close eye on in the week ahead. On Tuesday, August 30th, Sonos has a media event planned to announce a new product of some sort. Some are guessing it might actually be along the lines of an Amazon Echo competitor, with the invite saying, quote, come here. How it's all connected. We shall see how it's all connected, or hear how it's all connected soon enough. On Wednesday, August 31st, Amazon Video will begin streaming three of its pilots on Twitch for the very first time, including The Tick, which makes some people happy, and Jean-Claude Van Johnson, though you'll only have 24 hours to watch them, so make sure to catch them fast. Also on Wednesday, Microsoft will shut down its Sunrise calendar app that it acquired last year with plans to put that team to work on Outlook. On Thursday, September 1st, ahead of the Friday launch of IFA 2016 in Berlin, Samsung has a press conference scheduled, and the invites hint at some sort of wearable, with many guessing the Gear S3 is imminent. And Sony will also hold its own event on Thursday at IFA, where the invite shows products from all kinds of categories. So it's anyone's guess what the company will unveil, but expect a little bit of smartphone, headphones, camera, and VR, as far as I can tell from the invite. That's a quick look at a few items we'll be watching in the week ahead. Catch Megan Maroney and myself all week on Tech News Today as we chat about these and anything else that happens to break in the world of technology. Back to you, Leo.
That's your daily dose of tech news, Monday through Friday, 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, 2300 UTC. Tech News Today. Our show today brought to you by Texture. It's kind of like Netflix for magazines. If you binge on Netflix shows, you'll love binging on magazines. I'm a big fan of magazines. I think some great journalism, some of the best journalism, is still being done in weekly and monthly magazines. The problem is, you know, Rolling Stone, Vanity Fair, New Yorker, there's almost always one article I want to read in every issue. But are you going to subscribe to all those magazines just for that one article? And it's not all on the web, I got to tell you. Or are you going to go to the newsstand or grocery store and buy? I got to come home with a stack of Us and People and you know, and National Geographic. No, texture is so much better. You pay one low flat rate per month, and you get all the magazines, up to 200 of the best magazines, and you get them on your iPad or your iPhone or your Android device, and you can read them, and it's every page that's in the magazine on the newsstand today, plus back issues, and bonus features that aren't in the magazines, like video. Now, I admit I'm not going to buy a copy of People, but every once in a while I want to know what's happening with the, you know, the Gosselin family or what's the latest gossip. So I like to read that. I love recipes from Bon Appetit. I want to you know, see the latest Rolling Stone stuff. They do. There's some great journalism in Rolling Stone. I just don't want it cluttering. And some great pictures, apparently, of James Corden. I don't want it cluttering my coffee table. Or, you know, killing all those trees for something I'm just going to read one or two articles on. That's why I love it. And plus, you'll read stuff that maybe you wouldn't even get, like the Billboard Hot 100 charts or that great National Geographic layout. Or maybe you just want to find out what's the best dishwasher in Consumer Reports. All of that for one low flat fee. And they even give you ideas for things you might want to read in their top stories and new and noteworthy sections. They're curated categories. They give you a lot of information. Sign up to Texture right now. You'll gain insider access to all the content from the world's most in-demand publications. That includes, yes, National Geographic and Sports Illustrated and Time and Esquire and Vogue. Texture.com/twit. We got a free trial for you. I think you're going to really like it. And I know if you're going on vacation this month, you want to have some beach reading. What better way? You don't bring all those magazines. Bring an iPad and Texture. By the way, up to 5 devices per account means the whole family can use that Texture subscription. Texture.com/twit. We thank them so much for their support of This Week in Tech. We should talk about this big zero day. You saw Steve Gibson talking about the Johns Hopkins research on messages and discovering that maybe there were some backdoor holes to messages. If, for instance, a message didn't get delivered or was stored on iCloud, the good news is Apple's fixing those retroactively. Bigger problem, though, with these iOS flaws. An Israeli security company, apparently. So, do you know the story, Jason? Can you fill me in instead of me just telling the whole story, or shall I walk us?
So there was
through
a dissident in the United Arab Emirates who got a text message from somebody.
Ahmed Mansour got two.
Yeah, and they seemed suspicious.
And he'd been attacked before.
Yeah.
And so the UAE government.
What he ended up doing was taking them to a security expert who analyzed them and discovered that this was actually a zero day. It was a vector not previously known that would actually allow code execution of root access on the iPhone. That's bad. That's really bad.
Complete ownership.
Yeah.
And there's, you turned your iPhone into the ultimate spy device.
Exactly.
Microphone, camera, GPS.
They can jailbreak up.
Everything you can. It's basically a jailbreak. And they can put whatever they want on remotely. So Lookout's vice president of security research. Remember, security companies like Lookout, which sell software to protect you, may sometimes overstate these. Says this is the most sophisticated bad actor we've ever seen targeting mobile phones in the wild. The malware came from an Israeli company called NSO Group. It's owned by a U.S. private equity firm, Francisco Partners. And apparently, this NSO Group will sell these exploits. Instead of telling Apple, which would be the right thing to do, so Apple could patch it before it got in the wild, they hold on to these. And this is, unfortunately, a widespread trend among security companies. Mm-hmm. And sell them to the highest bidder. Now, NSO Group says we'll only sell to legal entities. But the problem is a legal entity in the United Arab Emirates, the government, may do things that we don't particularly are thrilled about, including target dissidents.
Well, and remember the Apple FBI case was the rumor there was that what the FBI ended up doing was paying an Israeli security firm. I'm not sure if it's the same one or a different one, but that was the rumor to get an unlock for that iPhone. So this is the idea here is that they're doing security research, and rather than getting a bounty from the vendor, they wait for a really well-heeled client to come to them and pay to use that. Which, I mean, this is the thing. If your job is spying, there's no interest in theoretically, in having these bugs fixed. Of course, the argument would be somebody's probably also spying on you, and you might want those bugs fixed, but they're more interested in having it as a vector for spying on
That's
who they
the
need
problem,
to.
That's the problem, is it's not just the NSO group. They're bad guys who may discover the same flaw and take advantage of it. So by not patching it, they're making us all vulnerable in their either effort to make money or, in the case of U.S. law enforcement, in the effort to catch terrorists, but it makes us all less safe. Apple did just start their own bug bounty program.
They did.
Offering, a couple of $100,000.
Depends on what the flaw is, and they've got sort of a different list. But, they announced that at Black Hat. The video actually just went online. I think I saw it this week. They've got the whole video there, which details a bunch of the security stuff that
they're
doing.
That was a good talk, by the way. Watch that talk if you're interested in a deep dive in how Apple does security. Of course, as soon as Apple announces that bounty, a private firm announces, oh, we'll give you twice that much. Give it to us instead.
Yeah, right.
And this is why Apple didn't want to offer a bounty. They didn't want to get in a bidding war with governments and other security agencies. This is appalling. There are 3 zero-day flaws in iOS. They've been around for a long time, maybe even years. This is appalling. And I don't blame Apple for this. I blame these security companies who are acting, I think, irresponsibly.
Right.
They're finding it, but they need to tell Apple. And in this case, Apple did learn of these and has patched them, which is why it's absolutely vital to install iOS 9.3.5. You got pushed it this week.
Yeah.
Because now it's known. Now it's out there. Did we see any in the wild exploits?
I think the one that's known is the UAE.
Ahmed Mansour. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He says, I'm a regular target for the authorities here. Every time they get new spyware, they seem to try it out on me. So
he's an early adopter.
Yeah. So he was smart enough not to click that link. He sent it off to Toronto's Citizens Lab, which Citizen Lab is a great researcher working on our behalf. No response from the UAE government on this. The NSA group has a brochure that even advertises this stuff. They advertise Pegasus, is the malware they used on Mansour, as a, quote, tool that allows remote and stealth monitoring and full data extraction from remote targets' devices via untraceable commands. Nice. Citizens Lab says, maybe not so untraceable. They were able to track down a network of sites with the malware on it. Some of them using web addresses designed to trick you into thinking you're at a legitimate site. Mm-hmm. I was fished to a site that was tvvitter.com, which looks a lot on your browser like twitter.com, but it was, I fortunately caught it before I gave them my password. A journalist in Mexico had covered a corruption scandal involving the country's president appears to have been targeted with text messages also. In a Citizen Lab report. This is the Washington Post's coverage of this story I'm reading, by the way. Apple did fix it after Citizen Lab and Lookout told them about this. So Mansour's text messages arrived on the 10th and 11th of this month. Apple says we were able to figure out a solution within 10 days and push it out. They pushed it out this week. Get it. But it's not the last of this.
Nope.
Is there any hope? Should we not worry? Unless you're targeted by a government with deep pockets, do you have to worry about this stuff?
It's scary. The more we put in our devices,
yeah.
and the fact is, the more important what's on our devices gets, the more crime will turn to it. Criminals will turn to it. Governments certainly will turn to it.
And we know from last week's story about the shadow brokers and the NSA exploits against Cisco's routers. That our government's engaged in exactly the same kind. I guess you would expect that. Why would they not?
There also seemed to be a period where iOS felt, like you could use it in confidence, and it was beautifully. It was a beautiful.
That was a fool's paradise.
Yeah.
I think we can all agree.
It was, but now it is painfully clear that even the iOS. I think, even despite this stuff, if you have to pick something to be reasonably confident, you're reasonably safe on iOS is still a good bet. But
is it though?
Yeah.
I mean, does
the security researchers that I follow,
including Jonathan Zdarsky,
and Christopher Segovian, right?
At
they
the
say, look, iOS device, Chromebook, and put your email on Google, or if you don't like Google, Office 365. And you choose the big email providers because they have in-depth security teams that are always looking at this stuff, as opposed to some little email
your
provider.
ISP.
No, right. Don't do that. But they said still their recommendation absolutely is iOS, which is the by far the most locked down mobile operating system. And they really like Chromebooks because, again,
same thing, locked down.
Super locked down and limited to what exploits are there.
It's a trade-off between your flexibility and ease, you know, ability to do strange things or weird things, and your safety.
Yeah.
One question I have, though, about Chromebooks now is that now that they're allowing them to run Android apps, can they do that and preserve the lockdown safe quality that was one of the original pitches for Chromebooks in the first place?
Yeah, it looks to be that the way they're doing this sandboxes the Android app.
Good.
So, and I would expect Google to do a pretty good job of that. Part of the problem for Android is not so much that Google's not fixing it and keeping it secure, is that you can buy an Android phone from a lot of people, a lot of manufacturers, a lot of carriers, none of whom have the same commitment to security that Google has.
And almost none of which work all that hard to get you the updates as quickly as they should.
So what should we do? Should we just assume that assume that anything you do on your phone could be observed upon by somebody who wanted to observe it?
I suppose so.
I don't take any more butt pictures. I'm done. That's it. And I certainly don't do it with a smartphone.
That's what the Polaroid's for, right?
Is that why you have Polaroid film in your freezer?
supposedly Polaroid was actually... One of the reasons it was really popular back in the day was because you didn't have to take it down to be developed.
Right. You Nobody, take, the you guy at the one-hour photo would not see your pictures. Yeah. We're back to the way it was.
But it won't get on the internet unless you put it there.
Yeah, but if it's on your phone, so the other side of that is, we're all vulnerable. It's apparent. There's no software in the world that doesn't have flaws. You can't make perfect software. And if software has flaws, eventually somebody will find a way to exploit those flaws. But most of us are not targets. Now, if you're Ahmed Mansoor, you quite reasonably need to take extra steps to protect yourself. If you're a dissident in a dangerous country, then you should protect yourself. Most of us, we're just not targets. So we can just walk down. I'll never forget the Wired magazine article, or was it Fusion? Kevin Roos got himself hacked. Remember, he went to two different hacking groups and said, here's some stuff, hack me. And even though he knew he was going to be hacked, he still got spearfished. He still got attacked. There was no way he could prevent that. And he then asked a security expert, and the guy said, look, when you're walking down the street, you're vulnerable to ninjas. If a ninja decided to take you out, what are you going to do? Nothing. The good news is most of us are not being targeted by ninjas. So it's not like there is some universal security thing you can use to protect yourself against ninjas walking down the street. If you were worried about ninjas, maybe you should. But for most of us, the saving grace is we're just not being targeted by elite hackers or governments. And these are elite hackers in most cases.
Journalists are, though, sometimes.
Well, you might be. You might be. I'm not a journalist. I'm just some podcaster operating in obscurity in the middle of Petaluma. I like it that way. I do actually use second factor authentication. I do the things that one should do, and I, knock on wood, haven't been hacked or don't know if I've been hacked yet. Now, that's the other problem. You wouldn't know necessarily.
The scariest things are this intersection of people who are targets who are also not at all technically savvy because they aren't going to turn on two-factor.
Movie stars.
And that's exactly right. Movie stars are a great example. We've had a lot of hacks of movie stars where they just get a phone and they put in, password 123 and they don't worry about it. And I think they already exist, but there's going to be a huge business in being the security expert to the stars, right? Yeah. Because that's a huge vulnerability right now where the size of the target is vastly different than the security knowledge of the target.
The savvy.
That's the scary part. Not so much maybe dissidents and journalists who are going to get up to speed pretty fast. It's things like movie and TV stars and musicians.
Yeah, that is too bad. That's always been the case, though. The worst thing to be is a minor celebrity because you get all of the negative attention of a big celebrity without the resources to protect yourself. Right. That's always been the case. Did you read Stephen Levy's article on the iBrain in your phone? He did a really interesting piece, and I think for anybody who's interested in Apple and covers Apple, on what Apple's doing. Now, admittedly, this is interviews with Apple itself, of what Apple's doing with Siri and with AI. I think Apple's at great pains at this point to say, hey, we're doing this too. Just because Google's doing it doesn't mean we're not doing it. Did you guys read it? Any thoughts about it? Are you impressed? When I see Eddie Q sitting there, I go, oh, boy. Really? This is the face of Apple's AI research? I'm not, But he's VP of software and services. So
it'll be cool when Apple is a little bit more open about letting people further down on the food chain tell more of the story.
Will they?
I would hope so.
Yeah.
And they moved a little bit in that direction. I think there's more to go.
They have the money, the resources, not just the wherewithal, but the desire, I'm sure, to provide really strong AI. They have a challenge because they have to do it with still standing up for privacy in a way that Google doesn't and Facebook don't have to. That's a challenge for them.
It's, one of the challenges that is itself inflicted is Apple's focus on secrecy and wanting everything to be like a black box and not explain how everything works.
Time to stop doing
is,
that. Right?
Well, this is why this story exists, right? This is Apple saying, okay, we're not going to announce AI products that aren't going to ship. We're not going to talk about that a lot. But what we will do is we'll give an interview to Stephen Levy and talk about, we're doing AI too. We did buy AI companies. Right. Look, here's some proof of
it. 30 companies we just bought.
It's similar to the VR argument or the AR argument. It's like, where's Apple's VR or AR solution? The answer is it's in a lab somewhere. They're not comfortable showing it. They're not going to go through the rigmarole that Google and Oculus and Microsoft are going through. But you'll see a story somewhere at some point that is Apple saying, no, we're working on it too. And in fact, I think on their analyst call at their last quarterly results, Tim Cook even said VR and AR are going to be big and they're very important and our R&D budget is very large, right? Yeah. And it's like he's trying to say, no, we're working on it. We just have nothing to talk about.
That's for investors' benefits. Customers aren't saying, hey, where's this product, right?
No,
although they might be looking, and we are, obviously, but they might be looking at Siri and saying, well, that's not really doing a great job. I think Siri is kind of falling farther and farther behind Google and even Cortana and Amazon Echo, for that matter.
So that's why you get a story like this.
Yeah.
Is Apple wants to put out there that no, we really are working on this and thinking about it, even though you don't see it because we're usually very secretive.
I wonder if Google's upcoming Allo, A-L-L-O, might be also the reason for this article. I feel like, boy, this might be crazy, but I feel like when Allo comes out, there's the potential here for this to be a game-changing application. If it does what they've talked about it doing, it is a messaging program, but a messaging program with intelligence and with the capability to, and I think this is a brilliant design. Facebook had bots in their messenger. The problem is it just was a bunch of annoying automated chatters that just got on your nerves and you just wanted to say shut up. What Google's going to do is you chat with Allo and it goes out and does all of this stuff on your behalf. It intercedes on your behalf. And isn't that what we really want? We want a personal assistant. It may come out and we go, wow, that's nothing. Like Duo was nice, but it didn't change the world. That's their FaceTime equivalent,
right. The
voice calling. It's cross-platform.
Google's vision has some similarities with Microsoft. Microsoft thinks you'll have an agent, and your agent will negotiate with the bots on your behalf.
Yeah.
So you won't use a travel bot. Your agent will use the travel bot on your behalf.
Right.
And your agent will know a lot more about you because you'll be comfortable giving one agent personal information that you would not want to give to Expedia's bot.
Well, it's also easier. I don't have to remember five kinds of syntax. Mm-hmm. I don't have. Actually, that is one thing Google mentioned that I think is terrible. They've got their own now Amazon Echo clone that'll be out, the Google Hello, someday in the not too distant
future.
Google Home, rather. Allo Home. And one of the things, I think it was Google, I envision a day where you have a bunch of these on your mantle and you're talking to all of them. No, that is not the day I envision. I do not want that. I want one thing. I talk to that one thing, it talks to everything else. That's what we want. I want Scarlett Johansson and her.
Yeah, the other problem with the Allo idea is that you're inserting an agent into like one-on-one conversations. That was one of their demos where you're like, hey, to your significant
It would answer
other.
For you.
Yeah, or you would bring it in to schedule your dinner reservations or something. And I saw that and I thought, no. When I have a conversation with one other person, I do not want a bot in between
maybe,
us,
though.
Right?
Wait a minute, though. Maybe there's people that you know, bug you, and you could just say, okay, Allo, handle
Talk to
them.
The bot.
You don't even tell them. You say, Allo, handle this. Because, you know, Inbox has
that.
This great auto-answer thing. Mm-hmm. I've been using that more and more. It looks at the email. It learns how you respond to things. And it's uncanny. It comes up with responses I actually use almost all the time. A lot of times I'll write more. But if Allo's like that...
Yeah.
I can only imagine that my wife and I start a discussion and then it ends up Allo's talking to itself.
Yeah. Where'd this new calendar
honey,
event come from?
Yeah. What? Honey, are you still talking to me on that? No, I'm not. I'm not either. What are they saying? They're having a conversation. I think they like each other.
Google thinks we should go out to dinner.
Yeah, magic calendar. I've scheduled something for you. I'm telling you, Skynet, it's coming. Facebook, of course, working on AI as well. I think Facebook and Google do have an advantage in that we've already given them so much of our personal information that they at least know my name. You know, Siri is a little of a disadvantage there. Facebook is starting to do digital vision artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. Both Facebook and Google have open sourced a lot of the code that they're using, hoping that others will work with their code and start improving it. This is kind of the benefit of open source. The disadvantage is you're giving away company secrets. The advantage is if you've got cool stuff like TensorFlow from Google, people will start using that, and then we'll all benefit. Worried about Skynet? Are we getting closer?
See, and you said there was nothing going on.
See?
But this is the story.
No, but Harry said it was AI, and I think you're right. I think, but both of you are right. It's, you know, it's distant. It's not right now. Except that this could be, you know, the iPhone in 2007.
Right. Well, I mean, we're going to keep using it, and we'll complain about it.
Right.
And we won't even notice how much better it gets because it's still not quite good enough. And then one day, it will be, we'll just wake up and be like, oh, it's good enough now. Or the world will end and it'll be Skynet. One of those.
Allo will have
both.
Incognito chats. It'll have, everybody does this now, expiring messages. Everybody's also doing encryption.
Yeah.
A point-to-point encryption. In Allo's case, as well as Facebook's, you'll have to opt in to it. It's not default. Apple's is default.
Yeah, that's the thing that the security people ding Allo for, is that you have to go into secret mode as opposed to just having everything be encrypted.
Hey, at least you have a secret mode.
Yeah, you know, it's good that they've got one. It's just, you know, by default, it's not secret.
Yeah.
And that's because Google wants to be able to do its thing and process what you're saying and come in with a bot to help you out.
Unlike Apple, they're going to use a well-known open source solution, the Signal protocol, which is vetted and tested. It won't have the problem messages has. Unique keys for every participant.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, your assistant won't work anymore now because you're encrypted, but you know, that's it. That's the trade-off.
And that's why it's not on by default.
Right. I completely think that's fine. Because most of the conversations you have in messaging do not need to be secret. Honey, what's for dinner?
A secret.
Yeah.
Why are you trying to find out what my dinner is, Leo? No, true. It's just, I think the idea there is that then out of habit, you always do your things unencrypted. And therefore, there's always been that argument, right? Back in the days of everybody doing PGP email, that you should encrypt everything. Or HTTPS instead of HTTP on the web. Just if you encrypt everything, then
everybody's happy.
Then everybody's happy.
And it's not a red flag to the NSA you must be up to no good because you just turned on encryption. Yeah, I use PGP. I sign everything. And if somebody sends me their keys, then by default, our conversation will be encrypted, thereby making sure that every conversation will be in the NSA database.
Yep.
You know what? Who cares? Because it's just as dopey a conversation under the encryption as it would be if it weren't unencrypted. I don't know. big kerfuffle. We'll take a break and come back and talk about it. WhatsApp, which of course is owned by Facebook, promised they would not share user data with Facebook after the acquisition. Now they're gonna. What a surprise. We'll talk about that in a second. Our show today brought to you by GoToMeeting. Be a meeting MVP. GoToMeeting is the online meeting tool that lets you easily collaborate and present anywhere with a click of the mouse. Once you install GoToMeeting, you start using it, even for conference calls, because you have that capability. First of all, it's easy to start the meeting. There are plugins for Outlook. It's just a click of the mouse. Your client or your customer or your colleague will get a link that they can click. They'll automatically get the software. 30 seconds later, they're in the conference call. But if you want to turn on a camera, you can see each other face-to-face. If you want to share screens, you can. You can collaborate. If you're presenting, it's wonderful for presenting. You can, you know, if you've got a prospective client, you want to do a PowerPoint presentation, you can do that so easily. It lets you collaborate. It lets you see each other. You can be a meeting MVP. And the nice thing is you can do it wherever you are. Because GoToMeeting, you can even present from an iPad. If, you know, you can, it's easy to pass off presenter duties. So it's a great way to collaborate. You can send private chats and video links. GoToMeeting. Look, it's just the easiest, simplest, fastest way to do this. Be the next meeting MVP. Start your 30-day free trial right now. Just visit GoToMeeting.com and click the button that says try it free. Couldn't be easier. You'll be up and running in minutes with your first meeting. So keep that in mind. Maybe the next time you got a conference call, just say, let's go to meeting it. GoToMeeting.com. Click the try it free button. We're talking about the week in tech. Harry McCracken is here, the technologizer, currently at Fast Company, technology editor. Good stuff going on at Fast Company. I like what I'm seeing.
Thank you. We're having a lot of fun.
Yeah. What are you working on? You got a particular story you're covering?
I have a big story, which you put up yesterday. TV show Halt and Catch Fire on AMC.
I saw that. I saw your piece on it. It's good.
I think it's one of the best pieces of filmed entertainment about technology ever. And I got to visit the set and roam around the sets and see the painstaking effort they put into having the right computers on the set.
Oh, that's cool.
I talked to the consultants who they use to make sure that, you know, that the plots are at least plausible.
So they're now up to 1986.
They're up to 1986. They're sort of in the AOL era.
I watched the first beginning of the first season, and I had kind of mixed feelings, but it was fun to see the old technology, and they took apart a TI speak and spell and stuff, and you felt like it was, I don't know, was it the story of Compaq? You felt like it was kind of the story of Compaq.
And the other PC clone companies we don't remember as well.
It was kind of all mushed together.
There were dozens of those companies back then. A lot of them were in Texas.
Yeah. And so in 86 now, I love this picture from your article.
Yeah, that I roamed around that set when there weren't any people on it, and it was a lot of
fun.
Oh,
what fun.
They're basically in the era where AOL was getting going, although it was called Quantum Link then.
I remember that, AOL yet.
And CompuServe was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And
75106-3,3135.
73075,740.
That was our address on the internet. Mm-hmm. Can you believe that? And not only that, we remember it.
Oh, yeah.
And security was starting to be an issue, and that's in this new season, too. There is Joe McMillan is launching a company which seems loosely inspired by McAfee, which got coined about that time.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
The great thing about the show is it actually is about 1986, but almost everything in it is evocative of the current era and often kind of the eras in between. They're doing a lot of stuff with commerce, which is sort of reminiscent of eBay, even though eBay was about 10 years after the plot line.
So I loved Silicon Valley because it poked fun at technology and the modern day. And it was, I think they did a very good job with their technical advisors and their research at reflecting modern day Silicon Valley. It sounds like they've done the same thing here with Halt and Catch Fire. They have some really good experts consulting.
They have
them.
A guy named Carl Ledbetter who actually worked for IBM when the IBM PC came out. And he worked at Sun Microsystems and AT&T. And they go to him to fact-check stuff, and he often says that's not quite right. You could do it this way.
Right.
And he'll give them stuff that shows up in scripts. They work with the Living Computer Museum in Seattle, which was founded by Paul Allen, the co-founder of Microsoft.
Right.
Most of the computers on the set are real, but the IBM mainframe, they basically built one from scratch.
Wow.
using the original plans and talking to experts.
I'm going to have to watch it. I kind of skipped the second season, but I'm going to tune back in because I love that era.
They sort of reboot themselves every year.
Right.
The second season was quite different from the first one, and this one is different from the second season.
Will they keep going? Are they going to bring us up to the 90s?
I hope so. The ratings have not been great at all. The people who love the show really love it. But after the first season, it wasn't clear it would be renewed. And after the second season, it was not clear it would be renewed.
I love it in this paragraph where you're wandering the set. You say, I see rows of desks equipped with Commodore 64 PCs, 5 1/4 inch floppies of multiple makes, Memorex, 3M, BASF, Flexi Desk. I remember all of these. A manual for Frogger for the Atari 2600. A copy of a spreadsheet program known as MicroPro Calc Star. Wow. Structured systems programming books. Countless other little pieces of history. By the way, I have two E.T. extraterrestrial cartridges if they want to borrow one of them.
The worst video game of all time.
That should be on the set, don't you think? So the story is about, are they making computers still? What is the company? What is Macmillan Utility?
There's two companies. There's Mutiny, which started out doing online games and then sort of segued into chat, which actually did exist. I went back and I saw that CompuServe had a CB simulator.
Yes, CB simulator. Yeah, you remember that? Yeah.
So chat does go way back. And now Mutiny is sort of segueing from chat into commerce. And Macmillan Utility is doing antivirus software.
Is there, do you think, agenda underlying it? Is there a philosophy that they're, what is their point of view on all of this stuff?
I don't know if there's one overarching one. I think a lot of it is sort of about the control we have over our lives and the control that the characters have over their lives in the show.
I'll have to watch it. And, of course, you must read Harry's article on Fast Company.
Joe Macmillan, he's doing security software, but he is clearly influenced to some extent by Steve Jobs. He does these elaborate keynotes, essentially, about his stuff.
Interesting.
And he's a very compelling speaker, but kind of a jerk.
Yeah. I wonder if that's fun. Wonder if he's going to get into, you know, move to South America and get into drugs or what. What I like about this is they're not actually, it's not the story of any one company. That's what confused me in the first season. I thought, is this Compaq or is it not? Or it kind of is.
Yeah, they borrow bits and pieces.
It's an amalgam.
But none of these characters are exactly based on anybody in particular, and the companies aren't either.
Yeah. Halt and Catch Fire. It's on AMC?
Mm-hmm. Tuesdays.
All right. And did the new season start yet?
Yes, it started last week.
So I have catch up.
The first two episodes.
Okay. Twitter. I don't know what to say about Twitter. It gets worse and worse. So they can't help. You know, I was just looking at my Twitter audit. 40% of my followers are now spammers.
Yeah.
You look at Katy Perry, somebody with a lot of followers, more than 3/4 of her followers, or I guess it's 2/3, are spammers. They can't do anything about trolls, but the minute you tweet a GIF from the Olympics, as Jim Webber did, you're banned for life.
He did get unbanned very quickly.
Okay.
But
after the story went out.
This is the whole story, right? That all along, Twitter has proven to be very good at monitoring NBC's trademarks and copyrights and really bad at something core to the service like dealing with harassment. Although there was good Twitter news this week, too. At least there was a story that leaked that said that Twitter is working on anti-harassment filters that are based on keywords. Unfortunately, the way the story was written, I forget who reported it, but it was written that they've been working on it for a year, which really had the whiff to me of somebody who was frustrated that they weren't actually. It seemed to me like it was somebody who'd been working on it for a year and was frustrated that it seemed like it was never going to roll out, and so they went to the press to sort of put some pressure on them.
Right.
But yeah, they do feel sort of like the gang that can't shoot straight over there.
The problem I have with a keyword filtering is all it does is so you don't see the harassment, but everybody else sees it.
Yeah, but still there. And then
what is the benefit of that? I mean, it's just like you're going, nah, 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 nah.
Ideally, it's all part of this quality filter idea that they did roll out to people. Ideally, you're looking at the length of the account, what the sentiment is in the account, what the words the account uses, and doing things like just hiding it for most people, hiding it for all people, or even putting those people in a holding
bin. So they could do the same thing about spam accounts too, right? It's pretty obvious what's a spam account.
I mean, if you look... I look,
but
and
they
I,
don't
I,
because I, they would cut the number of Twitter users in half. Because
I would, you see favorites of tweets that you made like a year ago
all the time.
You see, you see follows that are very clearly with a tiny bit of knowledge. You don't even need a complicated AI for this. It's very clear when there's a fake.
Yeah.
Following you or favoriting your tweets.
Yeah.
And I do report those as spammers, but Twitter's got the fire hose. They can see it. They should be able to tell.
When I see people favoriting a tweet from John C. Dvorak a year ago that mentions me, and the avatar of the person doing it is a scantily clad or most recently completely nude woman,
yes,
I know this is not real. So you report it?
Yeah, I do. I report those as spam.
I don't even –
when
that
I
seems
see
like
him.
A waste of energy because –
I know. It's true. And they roll up in Twitter for Mac, which I use most. They roll them up after two or three.
Yeah,
then you can't even see them.
Yeah.
And so you don't even bother. But it's very clear at a glance to a regular person that this is a fake account.
Explain to me what a spammer is going for here. What do you gain? Because I don't follow them, so I'll never see another thing from them. I do see it when they favorite tweets I mentioned, and maybe that's what they're looking
Some
for.
Some of it is they're trying to create a pattern, I think, to get away from being detected as a spammer, ironically enough, figuring that if Twitter is looking for a certain kind of pattern of behavior when they start posting spam, that if they create the accounts earlier and lay some foundation of some tweets that they've stolen from other people. That's
right.
The other thing that you'll notice a lot is you the text of a tweet that you sent or were mentioned in that comes recycled from a bunch of other accounts.
Oh, I see that
weeks
all the
later,
time.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's the same thing. I think they're trying to feed it with what they consider good data to
so
trick Twitter.
Sort of AI
to not auto block it when they start, they turn on the spam engine.
Right.
Right. But again, it's very apparent.
Isn't that what Horse eBooks was doing? I loved that. Did you follow that account?
Yeah.
Remember them?
I think in the end, Horse eBooks end up being sort of like more of a joke than
Oh, it wasn't a spam account?
I don't know. All my friends have eBooks accounts now. I don't know. I don't want one, but I wonder how you get one.
Their last tweet is in 2013, alas. But thank you, Twitter, for not taking this down. They were just randomly taking bits
parts of
text.
Tweets. Parts like two not even, tweets.
Yeah.
And soldering them together.
Yeah. Space in your house, how to sell faster than your neighbors, how to make a strategic use.
Some text from a Google Books database, I think. It was amazing, yeah.
And then I think
don't
we
stubbornly.
All thought
stubbornly.
This... Huh?
Don't stubbornly.
Don't stubbornly.
Words to live by.
Yeah. Stubbornly don't. Don't stubbornly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and by the way, I don't know why that's big, but I guess 775
people love that one.
And hearted it, and 1,500 people retweeted it. I'm going to retweet
nonsense
it.
Is big on Twitter.
I like it. I'm going to retweet that sucker.
So now you're one of those people who's retweeting old tweets?
Yeah.
Do you,
time
will
to change
I
your avatar.
Flagged? Will I be flagged? I should change my avatar to a horse. I thought for a long time that the whole point... Well, and you kind of see it. Yeah, there's spam, learn to trade markets, and there's a link to an e-books. Right?
Yeah.
So that was the idea.
That was the idea, was that it's a spamming account.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just sort of baffling that Twitter. It's people have been talking about the ways that you could handle this stuff for a long time, and it's just never been a priority.
Twitter does have an AI group, so hopefully
they're not incented to fix things.
Well, I think they are these days because people like you and me and Jason are sitting around talking about it and
bitching and moaning.
And also, they want newbies and casual users to become serious about Twitter, and either they will run into problems, or even if they don't run into the stuff. They will have the perception that Twitter is not a welcoming place.
Right. Right. You got to love this plan in Massachusetts. Who do you think's idea was this? To tax Uber and Lyft and then take some of that money and give it to the taxis. Massachusetts has agreed to levy a 5 cent per fee trip on people who use Uber and Lyft. And then... This nickel fee, portions of which will go, of course, into okay, here's how it works. 20-cent fee, 5 cents goes to the taxis, 10 cents goes to cities and towns, and then 5 cents to a state transportation fund. Everybody wins except Uber and Lyft. How can they – this is so obviously written by the taxi commission. Mm-hmm. How can they get away with this? The law says the money will help taxi businesses, quote, adopt new technologies and advance service safety and operational capabilities. So you're paying for it via Uber. Lyft says we're pleased with the law. It's not perfect. I guess it could have been worse, right?
They got some stuff out of it in terms of it being clear. They can go and do pickups at the airport and the convention center and so forth.
The law does not ban them from picking up at Logan or the convention center, although there will be special rules. Ugh, what a mess. This does not seem good on anybody's case. Let's talk about T-Mobile. I mentioned that T-Mobile, which has been the darling of the geek community, is the also-ran, and they offer some nice stuff, mm-hmm. including low cost. They've changed their pricing now. They've got one plan only, $70 for unlimited text, data, and voice. That's kind of a bummer. And the EFF is saying now it violates net neutrality. So the problem the EFF has is with something called zero rating, right? This is the idea that some companies don't have to pay, for some companies you don't have to pay. It doesn't count against your bandwidth cap. Of course, if you have unlimited bandwidth, what does it matter? And then the side effect of the zero rating thing, which is that all video is 480p unless you pay another $25 a month. They also say, by the way, that the highest 3% of our users, those using more than 26 gigs of data a month, may see some slowdown. So it's another one of those unlimited that's not really unlimited.
Right, so they're throttling and they're reprocessing media.
Yeah, downgrading video.
Yeah.
And Binge On, which did this, I guess, does Binge On continue under this new T-Mobile One plan?
I guess if it's unlimited, then
what do you care? Everything's unlimited. I'm a T-Mobile customer, so I don't know. I think I'll stay a T-Mobile customer. This doesn't seem like a bad thing. Nate Swanner, writing for the Next Web, TNW, says T-Mobile One is garbage. And the EFF says it violates net neutrality. I don't know if it's
garbage. It's selective data throttling, right? That's basically what it is. Right. Is it, you paid for internet data, but they're going to throttle your video because unless you pay them extra. That you know, you're going to get a lesser experience unless you pay them extra for it. Instead right. of what everybody else does, which is you can watch that high quality video all you like until your allocation runs out, and right. then you're out of luck or pay more.
All right, let's talk about WhatsApp. This is something that people are getting a little hot under the collar about. WhatsApp, which is owned by Facebook, had promised, I think, was it right at the acquisition or sometime before the acquisition, that they made a vow. Let me see if I can quote this vow. Jan Koum, who was one of the founders, said that once when Facebook bought them, the deal would not affect the digital privacy of Facebook users. We don't know your birthday. We don't know your home address. None of that data has ever been collected and stored by WhatsApp, and we really have no plans to change it. Here we are 2 years later, and WhatsApp has announced that it's going to start disclosing phone numbers and analytics data of its users to Facebook. They still don't know your birthday. They never did, right? You don't have to give them your birthday. Or do you?
Although Facebook does.
Facebook knows your birthday. And that's the problem, right? It's now combining what WhatsApp knows with what Facebook knows. And that makes it a very scary bundle of data. Facebook Messenger does the same thing, right?
I mean, basically, it sounds like WhatsApp is gearing up to do a business model at least somewhat similar to what Facebook Messenger is doing, in that it won't be about advertising. It will be about business bots and business services
right.
that you'll be able to interact with through WhatsApp.
It's that same thing.
And Facebook will charge the businesses.
In order to be useful, we need to know more about you.
Right.
WhatsApp says, one thing that probably concerns people is the idea, because WhatsApp is you sign up with your phone number, so it has your phone number. That's how you're identified. Same thing, by the way, on Google's Duo. One thing that scares people is that Facebook or WhatsApp would give your phone number to advertisers.
Which they are not doing.
They swear they will not do that.
But I think WhatsApp's biggest promise was always, we're not going to show you ads. And after Facebook pays $19 billion for you, and is not going to show ads, they're going to do something to monetize it.
Yeah.
And it sounds like their plan is to do what services like WeChat in China have done, and to connect you with businesses.
EPIC, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, says they will file a complaint on Monday with the FTC to stop this data sharing. They filed a similar case in 2014. Mark Rotenberg, who is the president of EPIC, says many users sign up for WhatsApp and not Facebook precisely because WhatsApp offered at a time better privacy practices.
I mean, the writing's been on the wall for more than 2 years.
They didn't
now.
Buy them for nothing. Yeah. So controversy, not surprising. What are we going to do? You can opt out, by the way. It's not obvious, but there are ways to opt out of that data privacy sharing. But you know, most people will just say, "Eh, whatever." Mm-hmm. If you're using Facebook, you've already said, "I don't care." You can know anything you want about me. Facebook is changing the way trending topics work, by the way. They're firing the people, the team that was doing this. This was a little controversial because there was some question about whether they had a bias.
They cleared out the boiler room. Were invited to the employee party because they were just journalists.
Yeah.
They're just unemployed journalists again.
You're talking about the scathing expose by one of the former boiler room members about how they were just mistreated, shamefully treated as second-class citizens at Facebook. And he said in his expose that, in fact, there was some editorializing going on. So Facebook is replacing those people with a computer.
Mm. Solid.
But remember, somebody has to tell the computer what to do. I'm just saying. Computers are not inherently unbiased. They're just reflecting the bias of the people who wrote the software.
Yeah, so it looks like instead of doing... So they had this editorial group, and it looks like what they were doing was trying to do things like write headlines.
They were,
And simplify things. Yeah. And what this change is essentially saying is, we're just going to throw up a hashtag or a phrase.
No more text.
People aren't going to write headlines anymore.
Yeah. You could figure out what it's about.
Much closer to a Twitter trending topic.
Yeah. And you know what? The whole point is you see the trending topic, and you click on it. That's really what you want, right?
Mm-hmm.
More engagement, more clicks. There are still people, according to Facebook, this is their Facebook blog post, involved in this process to ensure the topics remain high quality.
Remain high quality?
So, for instance, if everybody is using a hashtag lunch at lunchtime, that will not be a trending topic. It also means we no longer need to write topic descriptions and short story summaries. And, okay, fine.
Did you see the story about Facebook now can guess what your politics are?
How would they guess that?
Oh, well, the answer is, they know everything about you.
All the people I follow? I'm confusing Facebook because I follow them all.
And what you post and what you like and all those things, but it will come to you as no surprise. The way you find this out is through your ad profile, your personal ad profile, because they're just using their ad targeting system to figure out whether they should target. The story is that the Trump campaign is apparently doing a bunch of ads targeting moderates.
Oh.
And the question was, how do you find who a moderate is on Facebook? And the answer is, Facebook knows.
Oh, we know if you're moderate.
So whether it's accurate or not remains to be seen, but they will take a guess.
I'm probably too left-wing for them. I don't see any Trump ads.
Anyway, if you go to...
I see an ad for a hair salon.
Facebook.com/ads/preferences and click on lifestyle and culture, you will find the U.S. politics section.
Does it actually tell you what your politics are?
Oh, yeah. Well, no, it tells you what it thinks your politics are.
Well, I'm curious. Facebook.com/ad?
Well, I missed it now.
Oh, shoot. I want to go there. I want to find out what my politics are. I've got a broken thumb on mine. I must have typed it wrong.
Yeah, shame on you. Let's see.
I could probably just search for ad preferences.
Facebook.com/ads/preferences.
Ads, plural. All right.
And click on lifestyle and culture.
Hmm. Lifestyle and culture.
And one of your interests will be your politics, apparently.
Are these my interests?
Yes.
I'm a liberal. You have this preference because we think it may be relevant to you based on what you do on Facebook.
Yeah.
Then you could see what ads you would get.
And in this section, it's fascinating, actually. All of this stuff is things that Facebook infers about you based on your behavior on Facebook.
It says I'm a late adopter of technology.
I'm down as an early adopter here. And a parent with teenager. Yeah.
Yep. They know my kids' age, 18 to 26.
Yeah. Generation X got me. I'm going to get ads for Gen X products. And
what does it mean? I'm away from family?
It says that for me too.
People who travel. I think if you travel and are away from family, they do
it
that.
It says I'm interested in my friends' upcoming birthdays.
Interesting.
What is friends of anniversary within 30 days? I don't even know what that means.
I don't.
This computer obviously wrote this.
I'm a new smartphone and tablet owner.
Oh, congratulations.
Congratulations, yeah.
At any given moment, I probably am.
Wow.
Anyway, it knows a lot about you is what I'm saying.
And here's advertisers with my contact info. That's interesting. How did the Arthritis Foundation get my contact info? What do they know about me that I don't know? That's interesting. Well, this is good to know about. So facebook.com/ads/preferences.
Right.
It says I'm into the Gregorian calendar.
Who isn't, though? I mean, are you a Julian guy? I think
well,
you are.
Well, I named my son Julian, so you tell me.
Does Facebook think you're in? Wait a minute. Into the Gregorian calendar? Really?
So it says.
You must post a lot of things about, like, solstices and equinoxes.
What kind of weirdo are you?
I don't know.
But it did notice I like to do Polaroid stuff. It says I like instant cameras and instant film.
Big Leap Day guy?
It says I like solid.
I'm big into Leap Day.
It says I like solid state drives, which I guess I do.
I do too, but I don't see that on my preferences.
I don't write about them, though.
You should be able to add preferences.
I got the two big X's here, the Mac OS 10 and the Generation X. So I'm.
Are you Gen X?
I am. Yeah, Reality Bites, man. I don't know. It's a movie. Anyway.
I don't know because I'm not Gen X. Gen whatever came before X.
It says I'm very liberal, which is certainly not how I would describe it.
Oh, I'm not very liberal.
That's what it
I'm
said to me, liberal. And I am absolutely not that. But, you know, whatever. I live in Marin County. It's a pretty good guess.
Probably the zip code has something to do with it. I love it that I'm a late adopter of technology.
That is amazing.
I don't think I could be more opposite of the late adopter of technology if I tried.
You know, talk to Facebook about it, man. I think maybe they know more than you do about yourself.
What do you get if you're a late adopter? What kind of ads do you get?
Oh,
you
can, AOL, CDs.
You can't put a little frowny face saying, I'm not interested in technology late adopters. Apparently, they're having a hard time finding an ad for a technology late adopter.
Maybe it's all the stuff you click on when you're trying to help people on your radio
maybe.
Show.
Maybe. All those Windows XP links I keep looking at. Facebook knows. That could be. It'd be interesting, wouldn't it? All right, we're going to take a little break because I want you to be in. Oh, I want to show you this. Look at this. Oh, I love this. This is the stuff I saved from my trunk club, last trunk club I got. Trunk club is awesome. Trunk club is for people who don't like to shop and yet want to look nice, want to dress nice. And, you know, you get a personal shopper. You don't have to go to the store. They will send you your trunk with clothes that match your style, your interest. And they'll do all of that for free. In fact, you don't even pay for the items in the trunk. You just pay for what you keep. I did keep the mustache bow tie because that is a look. That's a hipster bow tie. And then if you want to be undercover, you just flip it over. And now you're just like a banker. That's a banker bow tie. I kept a nice polo shirt. I love this. Beautiful soft cotton. Trunk Club gives you a stylist. You talk to your stylist on the phone. I love my stylist. I'm not telling you her name because I don't want to lose her. She's awesome. You can talk about, I told her I'm fat. And, you know, but I said chunky. Or no, maybe I said hunky. I said something. I gave her the idea that I don't want the skinny clothes. But she didn't laugh at me. I like that. She helped me find clothes that would look good, fit my style. What they do after they talk to you is they create a website. You go through it. You say yay or nay. Then you get a trunk. You have 5 days to try on the clothes. It's kind of fun. Do a little fashion show. And pick what you like and you send the rest back. It's not a subscription service, by the way. You're not going to get another trunk in a month. No, you only get a trunk when you ask for a trunk. Shipping is free. In fact, everything is free. You only pay for the items you keep. Now, this is backed by Nordstrom. So great quality, great customer service. And they do have Trunk Club clubhouses you can go to in Dallas, New York, L.A., Chicago, or D.C., and you can meet your stylist in person. That also has an advantage because they will do tailored clothing for you, too. If you go into the clubhouse and get measured, they'll do tailored clothing for you. Premium clothes, expert advice, no work, and your own personal stylist. This is for people who don't want to shop, who don't like to shop, but like to dress nice. Sometimes you need a nice little wardrobe. And by the way, good news, it was just for men, remember? They got Trunk Club for women, too, now. Go to trunkclub.com/twit. That way they'll know you heard about it on Twit. And get your style together. They have a really nice variety of stuff. TrunkClub.com/Twit. And we thank them so much for their support of our program. Facebook's newest app may have a huge security problem for teens. Facebook has a new teen app. I don't have any. It's called Life Stage. And the idea is if you're under 18, you use this instead of Facebook. It's like training wheels. It's like my first Facebook. It relies on self-reporting. So you all you have to do is say you're 18 and choose a high school. So I guess there's some people worried that maybe people who go after under 18 people might use this as a way to target them. It will not provide access to content from other people for users who list an age above 21. But again, the verification is kind of weak. Facebook does ask you to report suspicious activity. Real Facebook?
Yeah, no, actually, my daughter, who's about to turn 15, doesn't use Facebook at all.
Good for her. Snapchat, right?
It's Snapchat.
That's the problem. That's why Facebook's doing this.
Yeah, well, that's exactly it, is that they have decided to sort of lay off the teen market for lots of good reasons, but other companies aren't laying off that market, and so they're getting way behind.
That's the market you want, too, from advertisers.
Although, my daughter's really into Instagram, so Facebook's got her there.
Now, that's interesting. Does she use the stories feature on Instagram?
I'm not sure if she's using Instagram stories yet because she's so comfortable using Snapchat stories.
But there's no reason to,
I think if you already are a power user of Snapchat, though, there's no reason to use Instagram. I think the Instagram stuff is great for people like me who still kind of boggle when I try to use Snapchat, but I get how Instagram works. So,
do you do stories?
I haven't tried to make one, but I've started looking at them. So the next step is to try to make one. I thought about making one the other day. Next time I'm somewhere doing something that I feel like merits it, I'll probably give it a go. I'm not sure if anybody wants to see my walk with the dog, but we'll see.
I just don't want anything to disappear after 24 hours. I'm the exact opposite. I feel like if I'm going to put the energy into making something, I want people to see it later. It's me. I want to see it later. I love my Instagram photos because I can go back through time and look at my history. And
that's why we're old.
Oh.
Late adopters.
So how about this? So it's only a week after Gawker announced its demise, and they had a wake, and Nick Denton said goodbye and wrote a bunch of articles, and Peter Thiel declared victory, and of course, Peter Thiel was the billionaire PayPal gang member and venture capitalist who funded Hulk Hogan's lawsuit that put Gawker out of business. Well, I don't know how you feel about Peter Thiel going after Gawker. There are a lot of people, even people who hate Gawker. I'm surprised to see Jenny Jardin, who has very good reason to hate Gawker, as do I, saying, oh, this is terrible that Peter Thiel went after him. I feel like he used the legal process. It's not like he sent a hitman. He took him to court through a proxy. Well, now there's a new service, legalist.us, data-backed litigation financing. We fund your court case. Wow. Our algorithms analyze millions of court cases to source, vet, and finance commercial litigation. Find out if your lawsuit qualifies for financing. This is an investment vehicle. People with money saw what Peter Thiel did. Peter Thiel didn't do it to make money. He did it to put Gawker out of business. But they said, wait a minute. What if you only funded cases that were going to win? They say they've analyzed many cases in many courts. And if you qualify, they will provide you with legal fees until the suit is resolved. And then, of course, they take a cut. Half? I'm not sure how much. For a long time, there's been contingency lawyers, but this takes it to the next level. I'm going to read a little more. Help me apply. Who should I sue?
It's an interesting idea, right? That the idea is that if you have a large enough group and you make bets that are
data-driven.
Pretty data-driven, which makes them okay. Like, they don't have to be perfect, but they just have to be better. You will get a return on your investment.
Right. It's just like any market.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's very, very much like a, Wall Street investor.
Yeah. It's a venture fund.
Mm-hmm.
We are only paid if you win the case at trial or reach a settlement. If your litigation is unsuccessful, you owe us nothing. However, of course, with litigation financing, you can get the best lawyers and not have to worry about legal costs. I would, you know what? If I felt like I had to go after somebody, if I were Hulk Hogan, I would use this. It's not illegal. I don't even, is it sketch?
I mean, as a, I'm not a big fan of Gawker either, but my problem with what Peter Thiel did is that we learned in journalism school, the fact is that one lawsuit can destroy pretty much anybody.
It's a chilling effect because nobody has the resources.
Exactly.
In their pockets.
And a reasonable case, you will end up talking about a settlement. You will end up, right? I mean, there are lots of places you could go there. But if the goal is to destroy you, then there'll never be a settlement, right? Because the goal, the ultimate goal is to destroy you. And if they can win, they will destroy you. And, you know, everybody makes mistakes. And one mistake is all that's required. And Gawker made a pretty big mistake. We could argue it, but that was a pretty big one. But it destroyed them. And that's the scary part, is that you end up in a situation where one false move when somebody is watching you will destroy any media organization. And that, to me, that's the scary part about it. And this, you know, this financing, I mean, it's not that different from contingencies. It's sort of like gaming the idea of lawyer contingencies. They're taking on the risk instead of the lawyers. I think lawyers might actually be very happy because they just get their money.
Right.
Right?
Either way.
And the investors are the ones who are taking the gamble.
Yeah.
Thiel also did it secretly. I mean, he later said he was proud to have done it.
Not that proud.
Not that proud, because nobody knew about it for the first few years.
You know, Melania Trump is suing a number of – or threatening to sue a number of
– She is suing one. Is it the Daily Mail?
She's suing the Daily Mail, yeah. But threatened others, including small blogs. And that was an interesting – in fact, there was a – I'm trying to find it, but I can't find the article. It was a retraction that was a non-retraction from a small blog. They said, well, right or wrong, even if we have sources and we believe our sources are good and we stand by the story, but right or wrong, we can't defend that lawsuit. So it has the effect of shutting us up. And so I understand that. And yet at the same time, I mean, this is the legal system we live under. I think it's a good legal system.
People get shut up all the time because they can't afford to go through
that's too bad.
Expensive court case.
But that means we need some sort of tort reform. We need to have a slap system where you can't file frivolous litigation because if you lose, you have to pay the costs, that kind of thing. It right now costs you not much, especially if you're a billionaire. It's easy to file a lawsuit, and if you go to Legalist, it's free. Just give up a portion of that. It's here sooner than we thought. A network of fully self-driving taxis in Singapore. This is from Nutonomy, a self-driving company that came out of MIT. It's based in Singapore and Cambridge. And they plan to deploy a fleet in the next couple of years of 1,000 self-driving cars. There are drivers in these, but, well, not drivers. Maybe they're more like observers. Would you get in this cab in Singapore if you knew that it's apparently not level 4, it's level 3 autonomy. So there is a person behind the wheel with the car.
This is the same as the plan in Pittsburgh, right?
The
idea is that there'll be a monitor, at least for the time being, watching what happens in the self-driving car.
Wow. I guess the question is the monitor actually doing anything or just to reassure the passenger? I don't know. Interesting. We're getting close. Singapore, I've driven in Singapore. It's not a hard place to drive.
It's a pretty constrained area, right? And it's probably mapped very well. So
it's
the area around the Google campus, probably a pretty clear place for a computer to drive.
I think they should have a little robot in the driving seat. Hello.
Well, that's Johnny Cab.
You're in a Johnny Cab. Yeah. That make me feel better. I think we're kind of coming to the end here of the show. If there's any stories I didn't mention that you wanted to, Pokemon Go. We haven't talked about Pokemon Go. Apparently, despite the fact that it was the most successful mobile launch in history, it has shed more than 10 million daily active users, engagement, downloads, and time spent fading fast. Sigh. I notice myself I'm kind of losing interest in the old Pokemon Go. But don't worry, they're going to be back. Some big changes to the game. including the long-awaited trading, some legendary Pokemon. And I heard a rumor that the next game from Niantic, the developers of Pokemon Go and Ingress, will be a Pokemon Go for Harry Potter fans.
Oh, smart.
Cast spells.
Yeah.
Avada Kedavra.
Yeah, you just need to have a little more for people to do than the launch version of Pokemon Go.
It's just skin on top of Ingress, frankly.
Right.
But yeah, I think they were hurt by their success. I don't think they expected so much demand, and they spent all their energies keeping the servers up instead of changing the game and adding interest to the game. Still, not bad. The most successful launch in mobile history. And finally, let's wrap up with a farewell to a guy the New York Times, actually John Markoff, the New York Times, says created the early laptop. Did you ever use a Grid?
I remember when the Grid came out, and I actually wrote about it recently because it was the first clamshell laptop. There were portable computers before that, like the Osborne, but the Grid really did invent the idea of it opening and closing like a book, although the hinge was in the middle.
It was a weird, and it was also heavy. So
you can see the Mac Portable was a knockoff of the Grid.
Yes. Yeah.
And there's a great, I think it's in the New York Times obituary, there's a great story about Osborne being at a conference, I think, when John Ellenby was speaking, and about this portable computer. And of course, Osborne made the luggable that was the size of a suitcase, and you pop off the top, and it's the keyboard. And then he opens it, and it's the Grid, and that Osborne just thought, oh, geez, right? Like, that was the moment of, I can't believe what I'm seeing here, that this opens up. And that was the computer.
It was 1982, 1 year after the IBM PC.
It was $8,000. So basically, they sold a lot of them to, like, the Reagan administration, and one went up on the space shuttle.
Apparently, for a while, the codes for the nuclear launch were on the Grid, and the Grid was part of the football.
So this would be like $10,000 in current money. It's very expensive.
A lot of money.
And look how thick it is. I did the math, and it's like as thick as 10 MacBook Airs or something like that.
Wow.
Well, the story is that it was on the Challenger when it exploded.
And survived
and was still functional.
It survived.
Yeah.
It worked. There was a version, according to the John Markoff, intended for U.S. Special Ops that came with a red dot on its black magnesium case, placed there as an aiming guide for a commando who might have to shoot the device to destroy its data quickly, rather than let it fall into enemy hands.
It used bubble memory. It had like solid state.
Bubble memory,
solid state memory at a time when that was really unusual and expensive.
Admiral John Poindexter, who was Reagan's security advisor and a computer hobbyist, had one. He would take it with him when he traveled with the president.
They were eventually bought by Tandy, so they became part of Radio Shack.
Oh, well, that explains it, because it kind of looks like some of the early Tandy portables.
Yeah.
In the 90s, they did, like, one of the last machines they did, which nobody remembers, was essentially the first convertible tablet. It was a laptop. You could rotate the screen around, and it came with a pen.
Oh, yeah.
So essentially the tablet PC, about 10 years before the tablet PC came out.
John Ellenby, he was a computer scientist, passed away at the age of 75, and the creator of the Grid, kind of a seminal
He was involved in the Alto as well, right?
He worked at the Alto at Xerox PARC. Yeah. Yeah, very interesting. Very interesting. The Grid was named because of Ellenby's vision of a grid-like network. Where have I heard of that before? That would connect various computers with one another, allowing them to share files. Kind of a visionary. Well, that does it for today's show. Thank you so much for coming up the pike and joining us, Jason Snell. You'll find more of him at sixcolors.com. That's his blog, Apple blog, pretty much still.
Yeah, other stuff in there too, Amazon and things like that.
And, of course, the incomparable, the great podcasts. On 5x5. I'm sorry, Relay FM.
Yeah.
And anything you want to plug?
No, those are the things. Yeah, check out the things.
Always a pleasure having you. Now that you know the new address.
I know how to
you
get
didn't
here.
Go to the old place, did you?
No, I didn't.
You knew better.
I'll send you a pizza sometime now that I know where you are.
Also, thanks so much. And you and brought Marie, which is nice. Welcome, Marie, to Harry McCracken, our technologizer at fastcompany.com. Where's Marie? There she is. Hi, Marie. What do you think of the new place, Marie? Harry's wife. You like it? Okay. Marie's great to know because she brings us great guests too sometimes. Mm-hmm. Harry is at fastcompany.com. Read his article about halt and catch fire. And anything you want to plug besides that?
Mainly that. I love it. I think I visited them in...
That must have been fun.
Yeah, I think I went to the set in like April.
It's fun to visit a television studio. Yeah, not like this. Like a real television studio. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah, I'd never spent that much time on one, so it was pretty cool.
Did you get to watch them shoot a little bit?
I watched them shoot.
That's when you realize this is much better, because they do the same thing 20 times.
Yes, I watched them do the same, like, one-minute bits over and over.
I would be so bored.
Yeah.
I didn't put this in the story, but Andrew McCarthy directed that episode, and the PR person said to me, I will try to get Andrew to talk to you, but he's famous for agreeing to do it and then bailing. And he didn't indeed bail at the last moment, which was okay because I didn't particularly need to talk to him. But I listened to him on the set, and he talked a lot about the fact that he's a writer, which I didn't realize.
Interesting.
He does travel journalism.
Huh. Very interesting. But
that's just, you know, it's pretty unusual for tech companies to let you just go in and sit around and hang around while they work.
Right.
If you go to a TV set, you can sit there and hang around.
It's fun. And I've done that I did that for Dexter.
Overhear stuff.
Yeah, the showrunner for Dexter was a fan of Twit. And
very different from sitting in a conference room interviewing some product manager.
I'd have a lot of trouble, though, being one of those actors or even on anybody on the set. Just it's so painstaking. It takes them a day to do 5 minutes of a show. You know, they just do it over and over from different angles, and it's just a lot of work. We just do it once.
That's it.
Actually, let's do this whole show again. I wasn't happy.
I think we can be better.
Yeah, with the open. Can we start over? No, we're not. Sorry. Hey, I want to thank everybody for joining us. It's nice to have a studio audience here. Folks who found, you found the way. You didn't go to the other place, huh? All right. You can email tickets at twit.tv, and we'll send you directions to our super secret new Twit Studios. We always love having people in the studio audience, so thank you for being here. We love it when you watch live, too. We do the show every Sunday afternoon, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time. That is 2200 UTC if you want to watch live. You can also be in the chat room at the same time, irc.twit.tv. Those are like the kids in the back of the class, way in the back there throwing spitballs. I love them. irc.twit.tv. If you can't watch live or be here live, you can also do the on-demand thing. We make on-demand of all of our shows available, audio or video, at twit.tv. That's our website. By the way, we're replacing those pictures. Those pictures on the website, those are all from the old brick house. We've got to put new pictures in from the new studio in there. You can also subscribe in your favorite podcatcher like iTunes or, you know, every platform has a Twit app. Roku, Windows Phone even has a Twit app. And, of course, there's five now Twit apps on the Apple TV. Thank you to our wonderful third-party developers who they're just fans and they decided to write apps for us. We thank you for that. We'll see you next time. But for now, another Twit.
This is amazing.
Bye-bye. Yeah.